Support for Boston Public Radio comes from North Shore Music Theater. Audiences can experience the true story and musical journey of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Jersey Boys comes to Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater May 7th through May 19th. Tickets at nsmt.org.
Today on Boston Public Radio, President Trump keeps threatening to declare a national emergency over the border crisis, but has the government shutdown itself become the actual one? We'll open the lines and ask what it's going to take to save ourselves from this self-inflicted wound. First time William Barr was Attorney General, his answer to a spike in violent crime was mass incarceration and aggressive policing that hit people of color disproportionately hard. These outdated policies are now coming under scrutiny during his confirmation. We'll get Andrea Corral's take on this and more on today's edition of Law and Order.
At noon, Governor Charlie Baker is here for Ask the Governor, taking our questions and your calls. We'll go over his agenda for his second term, if sports betting could become legal in the Bay State, and what new leadership in the MBTA means for commuters. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Eastern Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning.
Hey there. We should say, by the way, the governor has been on a bit of an electoral hiatus from the show. He returns today at noon. We're already getting a ton of emails, tweets, etc. If you have questions, the governor will be with us in studio from noon to 1. So President Trump has been threatening to call the border crisis as, you know, a national emergency. But has the government shutdown itself over the border wall funding become the actual emergency? There are reports of federal employees who can't afford their medicine. There was a woman last night who cut back on her own insulin. Interview and went to bed. She went to bed saying she thought it was possible she would not survive the night, but she was willing to take that risk as opposed to assuming even greater debt. Workers aren't turning on their heat. People who can't make their rent, car, or mortgage payments, or districts whose reliance on federal funds is forcing them to shrink their lunch menus. And the estimated $2 billion in pay that workers didn't get last week means the economy didn't get that injection of cash. The longer this goes on, so does the chain reaction. So we're opening the lines asking you, what is the way out of this? 877-301-8970. Should the Democrats give Trump his money? Should the Senate side with the Democrats? Should Trump compromise? And until the government figures this out, how much responsibility should the rest of us shoulder? Should corporate America, Chelsea mentioned this morning, should corporate America not be offering laid off, furloughed federal workers jobs? Should banks be giving out zero interest loans? Should credit card companies be suspending their interest rates and late fees? And what should we all be doing? 877-301-8970. I don't know why, but last night really put me over the top. This woman being interviewed by Cooper, Anderson Cooper, totally composed, other than at times you could see was ready to shed a tear or two, didn't tell her husband or family that she has diabetes, was cutting back on her insulin. But she literally said, matter-of-factly, I went to bed, had cut back, and I decided it was more important not to assume greater debt than, I think it was $300 for the prescription. That's another scandal. Better not to assume greater debt and take the risk that I might not make it through the night. It is unbelievable.
You know, one of the things that this shutdown has really underscored is how precarious the so-called middle-class lives are in America.
Yeah, you're so right.
That people are so close to the edge. You know, they used to say, I remember one of these books I read years ago when I was trying to get my financial life in order, ha, 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 that you're supposed to have enough save for 3 to 6 months.
Sure, of, that's right.
You know, if you lose your job. Well, people don't have enough save for 3 weeks, what we're finding out. And they can't afford their health care. They can't afford their mortgage. And these are people with full-time jobs. I was reading about the TSA people going out, some of them to go get jobs with Uber and Lyft. Mm-hmm. Starting pay for TSA is $28,000. So if you were making $28,000 in Massachusetts and you didn't have a spouse or a partner that's making a considerable amount of money, you're living in some hut somewhere. I mean, that is not very much money to live on.
Can I really am – my head's ready to pop off over this thing. But you know what's even more appalling? As of a couple of days ago, this number may have increased, but not that by that much. Fewer than 100 members of Congress, 535 members, 100 in the Senate, 435 in the House.
That's a disgrace, too.
Fewer than 100 members of Congress have given up their pay, donated their pay, written the check to the Treasury, whatever, which means 80% of these people who are at least in part, even if you blame Donald Trump like the bulk of the population does, the bulk of these people who are at least partly responsible, if not more, for this tragedy, and it really is, it's fine to collect my pay. And just, you know, whenever CNN or Fox News interviews me, I'll say how bad I feel for the workers. This whole thing is one of the great disgraces of our time. There's a woman, one last thing, and then I'll try to stop ranting, who was interviewed. I think it was Jose Andres, again, is giving free food. I mean, this guy is otherworldly, I should say, to furloughed or unpaid.
He's the restaurant owner.
The guy who got in a fight with Trump over the restaurant at Trump Tower because of his comment about Mexicans on that when he went down the infamous escalator announcing his decision. This woman is saying, and I know this is not an original thought, but she said it so beautifully. I'm worried about paying my rent. I'm worried about feeding my kids adequately. And she pauses and she says, and I've got nothing to do with the wall. This has nothing to do with me, but they are the collateral damage of this demented, childish fight that where there apparently are not enough grown-ups, whoever you blame, to resolve. It's
plus,
really horrible.
Plus, a lot of these workers are prohibited from striking. It's like the air traffic
Federal
controllers
workers.
Years
yeah, sure.
ago when the air traffic controllers went on strike and Reagan
Patco.
Fired them all.
Yeah.
That's right. So for them to quit their job, which is a scary thing to do, and go to another job that may not pay as much money, that's kind of their choice if they're running out of money to just quit their job because they can't obviously be working a second job or they could, I suppose, if they wanted to work 20 hours a day, but they can't work a second job where they're required to work their own job. So they're in that terrible bind.
Speaking of terrible bind and Catch-22, I'm going to get this 90% right. One of my guests tonight in Greater Boston is somebody who's got a TSA connection. And one of the security checks, if you want to be a TSA worker, is you pay your debts on time. You know, you're financially okay. So because TSA workers aren't getting paid, a lot of them are falling behind. Their credit rating is going to drop, which may make them unqualified to do the job which they're doing for free. I mean, it is just – and the fact – I know this is an old, tired theme on this show with Marjorie and me. The fact that we're all just taking this and tweeting about this, I don't know exactly what we should be doing, but we sure as hell should not be simply wringing our hands and saying how horrible this is.
It's fairly obvious at this point that the emergency is not at the border. The emergency is among those workers who are going broke here. And the disgrace is among all – you know, many people in Congress are wealthy, too. It's not like this would kill them if they gave up their salary.
I don't care even if they're not wealthy.
Well,
how can they justify when the workers –
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will have to give up her apartment in D.C. because she was a former waitress or whatever she was. She said she can't afford to live there without her salary.
Let's go to Barbie in a truck here first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Barbie.
Thank you.
Hi.
Thank you. I just feel – hi, how are you guys doing?
We're good.
Okay, good. I feel that – all right, regardless of the wall, what's next? What's he going to hold hostage next? He knows now that he has leverage. Say he gets the wall, what's next?
You mean if the Democrats compromise on the wall funding?
Yeah, they shut down the government every time he doesn't get what he
wants.
Knows
that that's what he can do. Maybe you've got a point. So what's your way around this? The Democrats just hold firm until Republican senators bail on them? Is that where you're going?
Absolutely. I think the Democrats need to hold tight, and maybe it'll put enough pressure on the Republicans. You know, regardless of forget Trump, maybe it'll put enough pressure on the Republicans that they go to their representative and say, hey, what are you going to do?
Barbie, a lot of people share your perspective. Thank you much for the call. You know, another thing I mentioned in the opening here, why aren't corporate? You and I spent part of yesterday, and virtually a huge swath of America is spending yesterday, as I did last night on television, praised Gillette for this ad.
Right.
You know, that's nice. They did a minute and 48 second enlightened ad about toxic behavior by men. How about hiring some of these? What do we have? 8,200, I think, furloughed or unpaid federal workers. I think that's the number in Massachusetts. How about hiring 500 of them part-time? How about other downtown businesses here?
Right, that would be great. But
doing
many people would probably like to keep their jobs. You might like being a federal worker. You don't want to lose your job.
I'm not saying they have to quit their job. But first of all, half these people are furloughed. Half the people are sitting at home and not getting paid.
Okay,
and need
the ones
money.
That are sitting at home and not getting paid is one thing. But I think a lot of the people that are required to work, they're the ones that are in, they're in the real bind because they're required to work and they're not getting paid.
How about that moron economic advisor to the president who said about a week ago, what the one who said, this is great, it's like a paid vacation.
Oh, my God.
Meaning that they will get paid at the end of the day.
He said they're better off in some situations. I can't believe he said that.
877-301-8897. I have to say, I generally maintain my composure about things that even that upset me in government. Mm-hmm. This has really reached the critical mass for me.
You know, my favorite podcast is the Daily, the New York Times puts it out every day. They had one this morning with Will Hurd, who's the lone Republican on the border states down there.
He represents more of the border than any congressperson in America, by the way. Former CIA guy.
And he was saying, as most people say, that there are sections where the wall has been effective, but for wide swaths of the border, you don't need a wall. And he was talking about the fact that no one that's down there, including him, that the congresspeople that live close to the closest to the southern border want the wall. But you know what he was talking about doing? You had a thing on your show about fiber optics and a much faster
Susan
internet
Crawford
service.
The book is called Fiber. It is brilliant.
And he was talking about this underground fiber optic kind of underground tunnel, as it were, that would be a high-tech way of detecting people coming over the border and would also give all these people who don't have internet service a service down
there. And really high speed. And by the way, that is what the Democrats are saying. Whenever the Democrats are accused of not caring about border security, the smart ones say what I hope is the truth. We believe in border security. We just believe the wall is not the way to do it, that there's a lot of technology, like what Hurd mentioned, who is a Republican, as you said, is this technology like that.
Well, that's what everybody says, except for the president. I mean, and the people that believe what he says, that the wall is not going to fix things, that the high-tech things, the fiber optic things, the more border security agents, et cetera, with some fixing of existing wall and some additions in small places of wall is the way to go. So he's asking for this money for something that has been proven, like trickle-down economics, to be kind of a fraud.
Let's go to Maria from Quincy. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Maria, thank you for calling. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey.
Hi, Maria.
I sound a little raspy, trying to get over a cold. I have laryngitis, but I had a call. I'll tell you what I've been up to. That's why my voice isn't going away yet.
Okay.
This is what I've been doing. I've been calling Speaker Pelosi and emailing her, and my congressman is Congressman Lynch. Now, my suggestions to all of the Democrats, especially Speaker Pelosi, I suggested that instead of waiting till February 7th to get Michael Cohen to testify, get him on there now. Get him up there today or tomorrow. The sooner the better, so we can have all of Trump's crimes on the record. And then, after we have it all publicly aired, have him testify, probably this week, then we start the articles of impeachment. Because this president has committed so many crimes. We already know about a lot of the crimes already. Michael Cohen has already testified so much to that, and that's why he's going to prison. There are so many crimes.
Okay. Maria, can I tell you, the reality, and even if your strategy is right on, there is, I would say, zero chance that there's going to be a serious move on the impeachment front until the Mueller report is out. I mean, that's just the Democrats have made that decision. You may not like it. It's clear to me, I don't know about you, Marjorie, they haven't said it in some, well, a lot of them have said it, that they want to see what Robert Mueller has to say before they take a formal position. So Cohen may help. And by the way, we're going to carry that live, we should say.
February 7th.
That testimony on February 7th. Yep. So, Maria, if you want your blood pressure to rise, stay tuned.
Well,
thanks,
you know, some people that were not fans of the president wanted him to get out early, and then, of course, that would leave you with Mike Pence. But you have to wonder, at this stage of the game, when Mike Pence is still saying ISIS has been wiped out, an hour after the government announces that ISIS is responsible for these killings that just happened, where four Americans were just killed.
Is your analysis that he didn't know that he hadn't?
I have no idea.
He's not a dope, even if one doesn't like his politics. To say that ISIS has been defeated, talk about not only embarrassing and factually wrong, how disrespectful to the families of the people who were murdered, not to mention other service people who are there. I mean, it's just, this is obviously the Syria explosion in Syria a couple of days. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. But the reason I mentioned that is because I think that Pence has so kind of debased himself. I just don't see him getting anywhere in any sort of political future, but I could be wrong.
That's Mike, right. Donald Trump will never be president either.
Mike in Waltham. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call. My thoughts are basically, without impact on everyday lives, you're not going to see any movement from either side. I think the biggest mistake off the bat was we're all getting our tax refunds. If they said off the bat, you're not getting your tax refunds, more people would be furious. If the TSA backed away, the lines would be outrageous at the airports. People would be furious. And then I think whoever caved at that point said, well, we're going to put the American people first. Maybe they're going to look like the winning party. You know, I don't know.
I think your analysis is brilliant and exactly right, Mike. I think that is exactly right. I mean, even if theoretically we care about our fellow human beings, meaning those 800,000 workers, not to mention the contract employees who are never going to get reimbursement for their lost salaries, their lost wages, it really is all about us. And until we feel the direct pain, it's likely we'll just talk a good game and not do much. Mike, thank you for a very good call. 877-301-8970. Are you as worked up over this as I am?
I guess I'm worked up because I'm not clear on how you get out of this. Unless you go back to the president's original idea of declaring an emergency to build a wall, and then that will be held up in the courts, and then that could reopen the government. Because I just don't know, since the Republicans have not been able to stand up to him on anything else, why are they going to stand up to him on this?
Well, you know, but we had Marty Walsh in on Friday, who not only is a Democrat, but I would argue is as tough on Trump as virtually any Democrat is. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, has answered our questions about how to settle it. And would you support money for a wall? He doesn't get a vote, but would you support money for a wall if there was comprehensive immigration reform? Indicated to us the answer was yes. Just incidentally, getting to Maria from a few minutes ago, the Democrats would not look like that. Some would argue that they caved to Donald Trump on the wall if they gave him a few billion dollars in return for which they protected, how many is it, 800,000 or
right,
a million
Dreamers?
Right,
but that's not going to happen because Ann Coulter doesn't want the immigration reform and the DACA.
Yeah, but there was not a four-week shutdown before. I agree. She's got a lot of power. And by the way, she baited him when she said
it is incredible.
Her second comment, if people don't recall, Ann Coulter was, oh, Trump's going to cave. And obviously, because he is so susceptible to that sort of baiting by the Ann Coulters and the Sean Hannitys and those sort of people. I am with you, by the way. I am totally convinced she's had a huge impact on Trump's decision-making.
It's incredible
here.
When you think about it. The vast majority of Americans do not want a wall. Mm-hmm. They don't want a wall. So the government is being held up basically by Trump's concern about looking weak in the eyes of Rush Limbaugh, Ann Coulter, Sean Hannity, and his base.
Well, I would assume, to give an ounce of credit to Donald Trump, I would assume he thinks it's pretty hard to run for re-election, assuming he is running for re-election in 2 years, if the promise that I would argue is most central to his first campaign, building the wall, if he has nothing to show except to say it's the Democrats' fault, particularly since he had a Republican House and a Senate for 2 years and couldn't get anywhere, I'm assuming his calculation is without something serious to show on the wall, I can't respond to Democratic criticism about my ineffectiveness.
Tim in Worcester, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, why don't we do this? No walls. Let them in. Turn all these border agents into a welcoming committee. Jim, wanted an answer. What is this thing? We don't have walls.
Tim, I'll tell you what I want. I want an answer that passes the laugh test. And even there's an interesting piece, I think, in the New York Times or the Washington Post, actually arguing for open borders.
Open borders, yeah.
This morning.
I saw it.
But I would say the likelihood of that even getting majority Democratic support, much less majority congressional support and a sign off by the president, is quite small. I assume you'd agree with that, right, Tim? That it's not.
Oh yeah. I'm a little bit tongue in cheek and sophomore. I'm a realist. What I would say is fight him all the way. Do to him what they did to Obama.
Got it. And by the way, Nancy Pelosi just had a little press event. We'll tell you what she had to say about fighting him all the way, if she did, in a couple of seconds.
And I have to say, I do enjoy her rescinding the invitation for the State of the Union on January 29th or whatever it is, if the government is shut down. Because you think of the picture of that. She's sitting right behind him, and he's going to go on and on for an hour about the wall and criticizing her. So I love the fact that she's making the president jump through a few hoops.
What do you think of the fact that he hasn't responded? At least as of when we started the show, he has not. It's odd because usually responds to any slight on Twitter in a nanosecond.
Well, there's a lot been written about the fact that he's not gone after.
What are they saying?
It's crying Chuck. It's not meltdown nuclear Nancy or whatever.
Because she's too tough?
No. The theory is, and I don't know, but this is what I've read, that he feels as though she's more realistic and moderate than some other Democrats. She will not impeach him. So that's the theory, that she's more reticent to impeach than other people. But it is interesting to see a guy who's obsessed with how people look, who's traded in one wife for an ever younger model, who's being raked over the coals by a woman who's pushing 80. I just kind of love it. You know what I mean? She's driving him crazy, and I'm really enjoying it. We're talking about the government shutdown, asking if this has become the real national emergency. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the government shutdown 4 weeks in, asking if this has become the real national emergency, not what's going on at the border. 877-301-8970. Here is Nancy Pelosi at her weekly press conference. Are you worried? This is the question. The heat of negotiations will get too hot with your letter, meaning the letter urging the president to postpone or submit a written document for the State of the Union. She recounts Pelosi's answer. She recounts stories of people impacted by the shutdown. That is the heat we want to lower. And I hope everybody listening to the show, whether you like Nancy Pelosi or not, whether you like Trump or not, agrees with what Pelosi said in answer to that question. What are you laughing about?
I'm laughing because I'm enjoying Pelosi tormenting Donald Trump.
I know you are. Jim and Easton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good.
I'd like to talk about the Trump-Pelosi shutdown.
Yeah.
And I think if everyone contacted their congressman and forcefully said, hey, do your job. Settle this thing right now. That's what you're down there for. Stop the politics. Get these people back to work.
Yeah, well, but Jim, if I may interrupt, I think everybody has that point of view. How is the question?
Yeah.
What would you instruct your congressperson to do, to vote for the $5 billion so that Donald Trump relents? What do they do? What should that congressperson
do? Yes, I would vote the $5 billion to get him to relent, and I would say to do that, you've got to give us DACA. And you have to put people back to work right away.
Well,
now, it's going to take years to build this wall. It'll take a long time. This can always be rescinded.
Well, that's a point. Jim, thank you much for the call.
I mean, it would be interesting to see if the president were to say, okay, I'll give you DACA. Because we all remember that the Democrats are willing to give him $25 billion
a year ago, exactly.
A year ago for this wall for DACA. So that would be an interesting thing, and it might be worth the trade. But I think you got to have something to trade and negotiate with, don't you? And we don't have anything. I mean, from the president's now, just the wall or nothing is basically it. And he's talking about a big wall. He's talking about the first $5 billion for something that's going to cost a lot more than that. As I said before, the people that seem to know a lot about this think that it's ineffective. But anyway.
Can I repeat? You mentioned Will Hurd, the Republican congressperson who represents the longest stretch of the border, who
was
against
great, by the
wall.
Way.
Former CIA agent.
Oh,
can
yeah.
Can I repeat
former
what we
CIA
said the other
agent.
Day?
Nine
out of nine congresspeople, Democrats and the Republican, nine out of nine who represent sections of the border that Donald Trump is talking about, every single one of them opposes the construction of a wall. The people
right.
who represent those communities oppose the construction of a wall.
And one of the things that gets forgotten is that 5,000 pieces of property in Texas right. would have to be taken by eminent domain.
Yep, yep.
So that's either businesses or your home. And for something that isn't going to make a difference in your life. And then you have all these interviews with people from the border in these different towns who talk about how they win the awards for safest community every year, kind of undercutting the president's claims about...
Well, I told you, I've been in McAllen. I was there years and years ago for legal services reasons. Not only is it one of the safest communities in Texas, which is
right.
where the president went, I told you, it was this brilliant interview with this young guy in McAllen, right on the border, who on CNN, who is being, I don't know who is doing the interviewing, and he says, yeah, the border's about 100 feet away from here. He says, we haven't locked our doors in 20 years, never been a problem, never. In St. Pelosi, in her press conference, which just concluded a couple of seconds ago, said she is not budging on funding for the wall. Robin in Worcester, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, Jim. Thank you so much for taking my call. And
sure.
I do have to give a quick that you are so fair. I never miss your show. If I'm not home at 7, I watch it at midnight. And I was actually hoping you'd get Charlie Rose's job, but okay. So now
okay.
that I've said that.
Wow.
That's really nice, Robin.
Jim
Thank
is smiling
you.
From ear to ear, Robin.
And beyond.
I never miss his show.
Thanks.
Absolutely never.
Very nice.
Okay, but a couple points is, as far as like the immediate problem with the health of different officials that workers working, I think they should be immediately put on their state public assistance, and it should be one of those special whatever you can do. Secondly,
by the way, stop there.
Like,
that is a very good question to ask Governor Baker, who's going to be here in exactly 30 minutes. That's a great question, and we will try to ask it. Robin, next.
Okay, secondly, I do think there's a again, sometimes you get your point mentioned in the middle of waiting for the phone call, that it should be part of a whole reform. The visa, people that don't leave on visas. I've sponsored people in my business for immigration, but it's a whole problem. But I think the world does have its benefits at times. And the final point is we give Israel $5 to $10 billion a year. They built the wall, so is it okay that we build somebody else's wall but not our wall?
Robin, well, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
We really appreciate your phone call. Our number is 877-301-8970. Remember we mentioned the wall around Obama's house, too, that does not exist? You and I were there, hanging right outside.
Yeah. There's a fence in the back, but they didn't build it. It was there before they got there, and there's no wall around the 10-foot wall around the whole
place. And
who
lives right around the corner?
Jared and Ivanka.
Ivanka. How great is that? So if they're out walking the dog or... Do the Obamas have a dog? I can't remember.
Yeah,
they do,
well, I don't
right?
know. They did. They had those. They had those Portuguese water dogs that they got from Ted Kennedy.
Oh, right, because of the allergy thing.
Yeah. Because one of the daughters, who's in college now at Harvard, was allergic to dogs. Those supposedly, the non-allergic dogs.
So, Marjorie and I hope you saw the video we did for Greater Boston Inauguration Week when we were there. First, we hang out at the Obama house like children,
right?
And then we go to the Kushner Trump house like children.
That's right.
And do you remember what we saw outside? Ivanka and Jared were not there. Remember what we saw?
This couple walking this dog in like
poodle
a tuxedo
in a dress.
Or something.
It's like a dress more expensive than anything
like
either of us own.
To the Metropolitan Opera or something. It was decked out from ear to ear. Yeah,
but
it's a very snazzy
really
neighborhood. By the way, for people who haven't read it, although that seems to be fewer and fewer people since it's been on the bestseller list for ages, Michelle Obama's book is really good.
Laura and Dedham, you are next on Boston Public Radio. We really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. Hi. Laura. Laura and Dedham. We'll give it one. Hi, Laura. Hi, welcome.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can. It was our fault. Welcome.
Okay. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is, I keep hearing about this law. It was someone posted it on Facebook, and I'm hearing people talk about a law that says it's illegal to not pay federal workers if they go to work. And I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think the law is the Fair Labor Standards Act, if I remember correctly. And I am 90% sure that there are two unions that represent the vast majority of these public employees who are getting unpaid. And I think both of them, the American Federation of Government Employees and the National Treasury Workers Union, I hope I got that right or close, they are, excuse me, Laura, I believe both suing based on the exact theory that you mentioned, that it's a violation of federal law to not be paying people if they're working. I don't think it related to the furloughed workers, but to the workers, the so-called essential workers who are being forced, like the TSA workers.
Well, it is unbelievable.
Corrections officers, that sort of stuff to work. Yes.
Yeah,
so, Laura, we'll check more. I don't know what the status of the litigation is, but I know there is litigation pending. Thanks.
Let's go to Darren in New Hampshire. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Darren.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to say we should be putting equal pressure on both sides. It's really political games for anybody, including the media, to be supporting putting pressure on just one side. I'm not a supporter of either side, but I am a supporter of the wall. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to hear you guys' thoughts on the technology stuff that we tried on the border 10 or 15 years back, but it was spent millions and millions of dollars and was considered a complete failure.
I don't know enough about your technology.
All I know, Darren, is that what I'm hearing from is that Congressman Will Hurd, who's got the biggest section of the border wall, and he's a Republican, and from the eight other congressmen who were down there, they talk about how there are some places where a wall is helpful, but the most places it's not. It's kind of not up to speed on the technology. It became kind of a rallying cry for the president during the campaign. You remember that he got a huge cheer in rallies every time he talked about, you know, the wall and Mexico's going to pay for the wall. But it's not effective is what people who seem to be fairly nonpartisan think. So that's what, you know, I suppose you could give him $5 billion toward fixing wall that's already there or doing walls in certain places if you wanted to. I mean, that's what people on Trump's side would say.
Darren, thanks for the call. The one part where because I don't know about the technology that Darren mentioned from 12 or 15 years ago, the one place where I'm totally agreeing with him, pressure should be put on both sides. Even if the Democrats have the position you want, pressure them, too, to cut a deal. The Republicans, Donald Trump, you support their position, pressure them as well. Inside, one of our coworkers says that the two federal unions have filed lawsuits, that in 2013, after the shutdown, a similar suit was brought, and the court ruled, quote, that the government broke minimum wage and overtime laws by not paying people immediately after their work. I think that is the Fair Labor Standards Act. So obviously they may have a leg to stand on. The problem is, unless there's injunctive relief forcing the government to pay, even if they win the litigation, that's probably going to be long after this endless obscene shutdown is concluded.
Okay, Brian says, why don't we just shut off the Wi-Fi and cable to the White House and that just stop things?
That's something I think everybody could agree upon.
Yeah. Okay, up next, we're going to talk with Andrew Cabral, former sheriff of Suffolk County and former public safety secretary, about a bunch of stuff, law and order stuff. Andrew Cabral is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 for another edition of Law & Order is Andrea Cabral, former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety. She is now the CEO of Ascend. And Andrea, my understanding is you've been permitted in Boston. Is that not correct?
Yes. We were before the Zoning Board of Appeal on Tuesday, and they voted unanimously to approve our conditional use permit.
So what does that mean?
That means that 272 Friend Street is the first, or Ascend as the company, is the first recreational cannabis retail store approved in the city of Boston.
So congratulations.
It's historic, yeah.
So when will it open? Can we all go visit?
We think later this year, probably very late fall or early winter this year. It's construction, so you kind of but we're waiting. We still have to get our license from the CCC.
We
have our ducks in a row anyway, and we've been permitted in Cambridge and in Boston.
Whoa.
And we await our state license and we're off to the races.
Is Cambridge on the same timetable or no?
Same timetable for opening? No, it may actually open earlier because of renovation.
Where in Cambridge are you?
You know, the Leachmere Rug Building.
Of course.
That's the Leachmere Rug Building.
Oh,
that's our site.
God.
Wait,
yeah.
The big one that's near the Green Line?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's right near Jim.
Yeah,
not
be
too
there.
Far, Jim. Be over there. So I'm dying to know what you think about the president's nominee for Attorney General William Barr.
I don't think he should be confirmed. Obviously, I mean, he's got. Let's start here. It's pretty obvious to me that if any nominee is acceptable to the Trump administration, that means that they're going to be hostile to the rule of law and civil rights protections and human rights protections, and Barr's history fits in perfectly with that. I think there's a quote in the story about him fitting in perfectly with the Trump administration. He does. He has a really lengthy history in the Bush administration. I think in some ways he's going to be worse than Jeff Sessions if he's confirmed. I think he respects the DOJ because he comes from that. And I don't think that he agrees with the fact that Trump demonizes the DOJ, but ideologically and policy-wise, he is in lockstep with Donald Trump.
But I was thinking about this when I was reading about him. What are we going to get from Donald Trump? Who's he going to nominate that's going to be acceptable to him and that's going to be acceptable to people that...
No one.
Well, exactly.
No, I mean, that's just the answer.
Yeah.
No.
So part of me thinks, okay, maybe this is the best we can do. I know he's got a lousy record on criminal justice. I know he's got a lousy record on immigration. I know he used to think torture was okay. He changed his mind, apparently, in the hearings the other day. But I just don't know. What I find encouraging about him is that he's 68 years old. And I said this yesterday, that he's an opportunity here to be a hero in terms of the Mueller report. And even though I know he criticized the Mueller report, you know,
he's not going to be a hero on the Mueller report. He talked in terms of there's so much to say about Barr, and we don't have enough time to do it here. But beyond the, you know, case for more incarceration, the memo that of which he is still very proud,
right,
despite the fact that even when it was written, I think the factual, and I use that term loosely, basis on which it was written was erroneous, but certainly he has since been proven wrong on any one of a number of things, not the least of which is the fact that crime has gone down in any one of a number of states and major cities that have employed less incarceration versus more. And he still doesn't acknowledge that. Even in the confirmation hearing, doesn't acknowledge that. But beyond that and all the groundwork he's laid for where we are on immigration now, he laid that groundwork when he was in the Bush administration. He did not say that he would release Mueller's report. He kept kind of tying
right.
it into, kept saying consistent with rules and regulations, never defining what those rules and regulations is rules and regulations are. And at one point, sort of likened it to when the DOJ or a U.S. Attorney's Office declines to prosecute and they don't say anything about it. When you decline a prosecution, you simply move on. You don't announce that you've declined to prosecute the case. So does that mean that if Robert Mueller declines to indict Donald Trump, then the DOJ just simply says nothing about the report and moves on? I am incredibly worried about his parsing of language, parsing of rules. He, as you say, he wouldn't be sitting in that seat unless he was acceptable to Donald Trump. And everybody with half of a brain knows what is acceptable to Donald Trump, namely the tanking of the Mueller investigation at most, and at very least, the report itself.
Well, let me say, I'm not convinced at all that Donald Trump liked this testimony, unlike the sycophantic, embarrassing testimony of now Associate Justice
Kavanaugh,
who yeah. I think everybody knows was talking to Donald Trump, not to anybody else, during that absolutely humiliating testimony. I thought when he said, matter-of-factly, it's not a witch hunt, didn't say, and you may end up being right about the Mueller report, which would be deeply troubling, I hope, to all Americans, but with some caveats, I thought he gave as much of a decent answer on that as one can. And I'm reading a lot of stuff about the criminal justice thing you and Marjorie were talking about. And by the way, if we didn't say, for those who don't know, he was Attorney General for the elder Bush for, I guess, a year and a half or something. That's when this happened. 3 years later, 4 years later, 5 years later, there was a Democrat by the name of Bill Clinton who signed into law a horrible criminal justice bill that he himself has admitted, Bill Clinton has, he did the wrong thing, essentially directing criminal justice in the same direction that Barr is being criticized for having done, building more prisons.
Because he hasn't acknowledged that he was wrong. The point in your...
He says he supports the current the bill that just passed Congress, did he not?
Yes, but he does not... there's a difference here. He does not acknowledge that that was the wrong way to go. Of course, he says he supports the current bill. Donald Trump signed the current
That's
bill.
A good point.
It would not be in his interest to say that he hasn't. But I'm sorry, I disagree with you deeply. I think that he knows enough to go before that committee. He can't say that it's a witch hunt. He'd sound exactly like Donald Trump if he agreed that it was a witch hunt, and then the plot would be laid bare, right? He has to be reasonable about this. He does have some credibility. He's not an unintelligent man. But I think that when you look closely at his testimony, he parses it just enough so that if he is going to withhold information that is probably more in the public interest than any piece of information has been in this country's history, I think he's been really careful about it, and I think he intends to serve both masters to the extent that that's possible.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral. So, Andrea, Marjorie knows, you may not, that I never miss an opportunity to do one of two things. Criticize Chris Cuomo and steal a phrase from whoever it was.
Why do you criticize Chris Cuomo?
Because I think he's atrocious. But I am going to make a big exception.
He yells a lot.
But
he's got great teeth.
But I never miss an opportunity to call Rudy Giuliani Donald Trump's TV lawyer, which is my favorite expression, which is not mine. I happened to watch, which I never do, Chris Cuomo, who did a spectacularly good and competent and well-prepared job last night, about 20 minutes of Rudy Giuliani, who, I try to be fair, had no idea what he was talking about, right. Giuliani. And you almost get the sense, as someone wrote today, that he isn't even talking to Trump or he's not in the inner circle. But here's a moment that is a huge one that is being picked up, but not as much, I don't think, as it should. Giuliani, again, Trump's TV lawyer, tells Cuomo on CNN that while Trump didn't collude with the Russians, as far as he's concerned, he cannot say the same thing about the Trump campaign.
I never said there was no collusion between the campaign or between people in the campaign.
Yes,
I have no idea if I have not. I said the president of the United States. There is not a single bit of evidence the president of the United States committed the only crime you could commit here, conspired with the Russians to hack the DNC.
First of all, crime is not the bar of accountability for a president. It's about what you knew, what was right, and what was wrong, and what did you deceive about.
Now, by the way, this is the reason this is a big deal for those who have not been paying wildly close attention. As the Washington Post outlines today, there are dozens of instances where Donald Trump, Sarah Sanders, and other people working have said explicitly, not only did Donald Trump not collude with the Russians, nobody who had anything to do with it. This is a major moment, it seems to me. No?
Well, he's a liar. Rudy Giuliani is a liar, and Donald Trump is a liar, both of them pathologically. But it's one of those things where at this point, you know that they're both liars. You are not surprised when they lie, but it is absolutely shocking the degree to which they keep a straight face when they do it. So for Giuliani to take great umbrage at the idea that Chris Cuomo would suggest that at any time he denied or his client denied collusion on his part or the part of his campaign, and he does it without a trace of irony it's astonishing. But the bottom line is they've been lying about this from the very beginning and moving the goalposts wherever possible. And they've decided that Rudy is the anointed goalpost mover. And he does. I don't know why they book him.
Lie.
The same reason that I don't know why they book Kelly Conway. And I don't know why they book some of these other people. You do not book people on a news show to lie. And if they come on to lie, you confront them about those lies. You do enough homework so that when they lie, you can confront them. And Cuomo did do a good job.
He really, if you haven't seen the whole 20 minutes, he was really prepared for this.
The look on his face when Julie, did you see the look? Just the look on his face when Giuliani said
Cuomo.
Cuomo's face. I have never seen anyone on TV look that shocked by anything.
You know what is great? And it's in the Washington Post today. It's The Fix. And they've got how Trump has moved and his people have moved from back when Hope Hicks said right after the election, it never happened. There was no communication between the campaign and any foreign entity during the campaign. And they go right
through. By the way, that's important. Forget collusion.
Right.
It started with there was no contact.
Communication.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there were no communications. Sarah Sanders, no communications to the best of our
Mike
knowledge.
Mike Pence said it too.
And then it goes
over
right
and
through
again.
A list about how they keep changing the story and changing the story and changing
As
the story.
As dozens within the campaign have found to have had, some more than one, have found to have had connection. And put this in the context of a country this many years old where we have never, ever, ever heard that about any other president or any other campaign in the history of the country. And here comes Donald Trump with 16, 17, 18 different individuals within his inner circle having had not just contact but regular communication. And he calls it a witch hunt and he calls it I don't know. It is staggering the amount of this that's been happening right in our faces every single day, the amount of obstruction and the evidence of this conspiracy right in our faces every single day.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral. In terms of incredible or whatever adjective or you used a minute ago, the now former president or interim president of Michigan State University, when people say things that are pathetically stupid and humiliating in addition to and vicious. You say to yourself, unless they have no brain, you say to yourself, what were they thinking? The reason Engler, who is, I think, a former governor, if I'm not wrong, of Michigan, the reason he is no longer the interim president of Michigan State University is because of this quote to the Detroit News. Everybody knows Michigan State is where Larry Nassar, that doctor, is now in jail essentially for the rest of his life, who was sexually assaulting
dozens and dozens of
gymnasts, who many of whom gave brilliant and courageous testimony both in the public and in the courtroom. Here's Engler. He's talking about this fund. And Engler suggesting to the Detroit News it would be for survivors who were not part of the original settlement that was determined earlier this year. Here's what he had to say. It's, quote, you've got people, says Engler. They're hanging on, and this has been, there are a lot of people who are touched by this, survivors who haven't been in the spotlight. And here's the key. In some ways, they have been able to deal with this better than the ones who have been in the spotlight, who are still enjoying that moment at times, you know, the awards and the recognition. These are sexual assault survivors who are at times, you know, enjoying the moment of the awards and the recognition.
Yeah, he
says it to a bunch of reporters.
Yeah, right. To reporters, even better. That's right.
And it's in the context, and this is why this is so important. It's in the context of him having been governor. This is not some sort of, you know, bureaucrat at the Michigan State University that said, here, just go be interim president, who then stumbles over himself. He's the former governor who, by the way, when he became aware of female inmates being alleging that they had been, was it dozens? Dozens of female inmates alleging they were raped by male state corrections officers. He fought against that lawsuit. So he actually has a history of being...
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, he has a history. This is, I think, back in the 1990s. He has a history of sort of ignoring such complaints to the detriment of victims. But you think to yourself, a guy who should be used to talking to the press or used to making statements publicly, I think that's one of that... What that means is this is one of those instances where he's saying what he was really thinking. He said what he really thinks. He really does think that they're enjoying the spotlight. He really does think that... This is like, you know, a great moment for them. I don't know. I don't know what would possess a man to say something like this publicly, but he appears to be blissfully unaware of the consequences of his words.
Well, he's now not unemployed.
Yeah.
What did Ann Coulter say about the 9/11? Just remind me of the 9/11.
I was just thinking
wives,
of that. Yeah. She said that some of the 9/11 wives were either happy their husbands were dead or were enjoying the spotlight
or the money
of being
or
interviewed or the money. She said something incredible.
Well, she's a ghoul, and everything she says is designed. She is a ghoul, and everything that she says is designed to elicit that
really
kind of response.
Don't you really wonder what's going on with that woman? I mean, I find her just...
I think she's addicted to attention, and she's... You know, she knows that this is the only way that she's going to get. I find her to be incredibly sad. I really do. I mean, I'm not one to necessarily feel sympathy for someone who inflicts pain so gratuitously on others, but I find her to be incredibly sad and pathetic.
Well, let me just say, she may be sad and pathetic, but as I said, I think in our discussion at 11 o'clock today, I really do believe that her line about how, oh, Trump's going to cave. Right in the middle, I think 10 days into the shutdown, or I don't know how many days, but early on in the shutdown, I really do believe that was the single most determinative statement vis-a-vis the behavior,
I think
the
decision-making
of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I find her sad and pathetic, but she's also incredibly dangerous and wields a level of influence. Having been elected by no one, by the way, wields an incredible amount of influence over the president of the United States.
By the way, in the words of Engler, she's enjoying the moment in the spotlight and the recognition.
She is actually enjoying the moment of this. I'm wondering what Mr. Engler is going to do next in his life, because I can't imagine who would hire him to do anything.
You know, you also wonder, I don't know if this is the point,
let's
maybe that's a reason.
A good retirement account or
you know,
a pension or
when
something.
When you hear somebody, I wasn't aware of his position in that lawsuit by the inmates who'd been raped by the corrections officers, but when you hear something like this sort of at the end of a story, the Nassar story, for lack of a better expression, I take time to say, let's look at all the decisions he made, which were obviously colored by this attitude that these survivors, these women who have been sexually abused, they're lucky in some ways. They're getting a spotlight. They're getting awards. They get to be on ESPN kinds of. And one must assume that if that's his mindset, which it obviously is, that it affected how he dealt with all issues around gender and sexual violence and that sort of stuff.
And keep in mind that when he got this position, the Nassar story is like the biggest thing to happen, I think, to Michigan State University. When he got this position, it wasn't like he was unmindful that this story, what a huge story this is, and what a deleterious impact it's had.
Well, the previous president had to resign.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Exactly.
So that's what makes no sense about this. How do you come out and say this? It's not like he hasn't had a million discussions with people about how to handle this story publicly, and he kind of lets fly in the middle of an interview with media. It's just unusual.
You know, we only have like a little over a minute left, but I wonder what you thought about the Gillette Me Too ad on so-called toxic masculinity.
That was great.
I thought it was great, too. It's getting a lot of a pushback and abuse, but
by misogynists. That's who it's right. getting
yeah.
pushback
the
from.
Only people that are weighing in are, you know, delicate, fragile men who will watch commercials endlessly that objectify women and show them scantily clad. You could probably run, Hooters ads back to back for 24 hours straight, and none of them would think, my goodness, that's objectifying a woman. Perhaps we should, you know, be better than that. But to suggest that the privilege to treat women poorly be taken away is apparently anathema to them, and they're all weighing in on Twitter because they all think their opinions matter, and none of them do.
Did you ever go to Hooters, by the way?
I've never been.
Marjorie and I, several New Hampshire primary election cycles ago.
Lunch.
No, we purposely went there because we were curious.
Yeah, for the wings.
Like, what?
For the wings.
It is really, depressing.
And
scene.
The women wear these industrial strength pantyhose that make them
you've obsessed
look
on
like
that. I know.
Well, it's bizarre. It makes them look like they don't have real legs or something there. All they're thick and covered up. The
you know
whole thing
do?
Was depressing.
We won't take you there sometime. How about that? Okay.
I'm there.
Okay,
yeah.
How was the food? Do you remember? How were the wings, Jim? Do you remember?
No, I don't. And by the way, I don't know if we said this the other day. We're thrilled this weekend at the closing ceremony of the Mass Municipal Association meeting.
Yes.
Oh, that's
Marjorie
gonna be
and
fun.
I are doing essentially a de facto radio show for the local officials with our two guests will be former Governor Jane Swift and former Secretary of Public Safety and former Sheriff Andrew Cabral.
We're
really looking forward to it.
Yeah,
I'm worried
about the snowstorm. I hope it doesn't
we'll be fine.
Prevent people's getting there.
See you Saturday, Andrea.
Okay,
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Andrea Cabral. Up next, Andrea, by the way, joins us every week, and she's the CEO of Ascend and former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. Coming up, the Governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker, is going to be here to take your questions and ours for another segment of Ask the Governor. The Governor is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
At noon on today's Boston Public Radio, Governor Charlie Baker's here for Ask the Governor, taking our questions and your calls. We'll ask him about his priorities for his second term, if Beacon Hill can come up with the money for education reform, and how he plans to get to GBH for Ask the Governor once the major Mass Pike construction gets underway. During his confirmation hearing to run the EPA, Andrew Wheeler, the former coal lobbyist, said climate change is not a crisis. We'll ask GBH's science correspondent Heather Goldstone if Wheeler's leadership could make the current climate crisis even worse.
Then we open the lines and ask you, have you become a neatness czarina Marie Kondo disciple? Or like Jim, are you a shopaholic hoarding dissenter?
I'm not a hoarder.
I think you are a hoarder, actually, Jim. Then we wrap things up with Richard Blanco in another edition of Village Voice with a selection of poems that tap into the civil rights struggle of Martin Luther King Jr. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. And hello, Governor Charlie Baker, who is here with us for Ask the Governor. The governor will be taking our questions and yours. You can call Governor Baker. Actually, the lines are full already at 877-301-8970. You can tweet him at BOS Public Radio. You can email him at bprwgbh.org. Governor, it's great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you, too.
Great to see you, too, Governor Baker. So right after the New Year, speaking of the New Year, Joshua Miller wrote a great piece about you, and I haven't seen you for a while, so I wanted to ask. He called you possibly the country's most popular governor, but he also said you're an enigma with no hobbies who likes to hang around writing wonky letters of dismay. Have you no hobbies?
You really enjoyed saying that, didn't you, Marjorie? Yeah.
Well, you know, but you do have hobbies. Are you an enigma?
My wife doesn't think I'm an enigma.
Okay.
I tend not to comment on stories that get written about me because I'm an enigma.
You are.
But if I were to say I don't have a lot of hobbies. I don't like to golf. I'm not a hiker.
Yeah.
I don't fish. I don't, you know, my hobby has always been my family and my kids and my wife. And if I have free time, I usually try to spend it with them. And, you know, I love books. I have a stack
like
of them that's
like
10
that's a hobby.
Feet tall. My wife refers to reading books as doing nothing. She's not a big believer in the whole idea that reading a book is doing something. But I'm not a big hobby guy. No.
Well, one last thing.
It's one of the reasons why I'm going to work until I die.
Okay. Well, one of the things I found very impressive about this story that said you were an enigma with no hobbies was that you apparently have a photograph.
I'm glad you've really captured the essence of this story.
Too, yeah.
A photograph. Well, it's not true. You do have
Governor,
hobbies. Reading is a hobby.
An enigma with no hobbies. Okay.
But that you were something about the closing of the Sumner Tunnel.
Oh, man, yeah.
And you
right.
have like a photograph. Yep. You wowed your aides with this photographic memory of the entrances of the Sumner Tunnel, which was pretty impressive.
There are like 11 roads that come into that two-lane tunnel. And I drive it a lot. I've been driving it. Well, I haven't driven it lately. Lately I ride because somebody else drives. But I've been going in and out of it for 20 years. And my favorite part was actually when they were telling me that I was wrong about some of the side streets, and I took out my phone and I showed them the photos of my phone.
I can feel too.
I can get into the weeds.
Do you mind if we get beyond the enigma thing, Marjorie, or do you
want
to
move on?
Further questions, Governor? Your quote on the shutdown that I've read so far is a pox. My pox is on all the houses down there. What should all the houses be doing? If you were the prescriber of a deal, I think everybody wants a deal. What should the deal look like? And also, you should tell us what impact, obviously, this is having on Massachusetts.
Well, let's start with the biggest impact it's had so far has been on the people who work for or contract for the federal government. I mean, remember, you know, it's kind of a partial shutdown because I think 11 of the 15 continuing resolutions or 9 of the 15 continuing resolutions were passed. And it's pretty clear so far anyway that the biggest issue we are facing is what to do about the people who work for the federal government, who either have to show up for work and don't get paid, don't show up for work and don't get paid, have been furloughed, or are contractors who work for the federal government, that is their job for all intents and purposes, who are not getting paid and have also been furloughed. And we've been talking to our colleagues in the legislature and to some other governors about whether or not there is a way for us to put some kind of unusual unemployment program in place for those folks, because their last check was due on January 8th. And if this thing continues, a lot of them are going to end up having trouble making February rent payments, mortgage payments, and all the rest. And that's really going to end up being, I think, where, at least in the short term anyway, our biggest focus is. Most of the other stuff, there was a big concern about SNAP. There are
food stamps.
Right. There are hundreds of thousands of people in Massachusetts on SNAP. But we think we have resolved that at least through February here in Massachusetts. Again, if it really drags out for an extended period of time, we're going to have all kinds of other issues. But the really big issue in the short term are the people who are working without getting paid or unable to work. Because the big problem there is you have a job, you like it, you're not getting paid, you need to pay the rent. I mean,
right. People
are going to have to figure out, through no fault of their own, whether they need to go find a job doing something else. Now, if you're already working for the federal government, you go talk to an employer and say, I'd like to come work for you. The first question is going to be, what happens when the shutdown ends. So, I mean, these people are just in no man's land, and it's not their fault.
So what do you want to see them do in Washington?
Compromise.
Are you, well, I mean, I haven't heard you comment. Would you, we asked Marty Walsh the other day, the mayor, who obviously is a pretty strong critic of the president's, if there was a comprehensive immigration bill tied to some Democratic agreement for some funding of the wall, would he support it? And he said, yes. Would you?
I think the real issue, first of all, I want the government to get back to work. And I'm a big believer that if you work in the public sector, you recognize and appreciate the fact that there are a lot of points of view at play here because there are a lot of different points of view in the country. And I'd be inclined to go with the mayor on this one, which is if there's a deal to be had, people should negotiate it. My biggest problem with the way everyone down there is behaving, which is why I said what I said, is no one right now is trying to solve this. They're just trying to figure out some way to blame somebody else. That's the way the White House is playing it. That's the way the Congress is playing it. That's the way all the various people in Washington are playing it, when it is really the people who we were just talking about, the folks who don't have a job, can't go to a job or go to a job and don't get paid, who are getting screwed. And that's just the beginning. If this thing drags out, there are going to be a lot of really difficult situations and circumstances, frankly, that state and local governments are going to be expected to solve.
But you don't have a principled objection to the wall, I guess what I'm getting to.
I think border security is important, especially the southern border. I mean, everyone who's ever studied the opioid issue in this country knows that a huge portion of the fentanyl and the heroin that's in the United States comes through Mexico. So border security matters. But with respect to what the terms and conditions of a so-called deal should be, they should figure it out. I mean, I'm kind of where the mayor is, which is figure this out and recognize and understand that that's what you're supposed to do down there. And if they play the zero-sum game and just keep making it about why it's not my fault, the message they're sending to the rest of the country and to all those hundreds of thousands of federal workers and contractors who are currently going without is we're really not that interested in you.
We're talking to Charlie Baker, the governor of the Commonwealth.
You know, one last thing before we get to the calls, because Mayor Walsh, Jim was just talking about him, said that you and he are going to go on the road and go down to Washington on a road trip to show that it's possible for a Republican and a Democrat to get along. And I think was it a question or a tweet this morning from Andy Metzger?
Andy Metzger from the State House News Service said he wanted to know who is driving and who is compiling the road trip playlist. So we thought we'd ask the question for Andy. What's the answer?
I think, first of all, I think this road trip is probably going to happen in an airplane and not in a Volkswagen Bug. And I think the great thing about the 21st century is we can each have our own playlist, even if we're sitting right next to each other. I think if the mayor wants to put together a playlist, I'm all in. I actually have no idea what he listens to. And
what is the point of in all seriousness, though, for a second? Obviously, his underlying point is that you, a Republican, he, a Democrat, have a very good working relationship, and that the working relationship between the two parties in Washington is an embarrassment. I'm putting words in his mouth, but I think we'd all agree to that. So what's the goal to go?
First of all, I've suggested to him, and he I think, would agree with this, that we should try and get some other folks to come with us. And try and make this about more than just him and me, but to make it about a group of state and local officials, electeds, Democrats and Republicans, who share some similar concerns about the federal government's inability to do much of anything around infrastructure and transportation and a whole host of other issues that we all think are pretty important. You know, when I was first elected and I went down to D.C. for my first National Governors Association meeting, which would have been February-ish of 2015, the governors all go up to Capitol Hill and meet with members of Congress and members of the Senate. And we just go, if you want to go to the healthcare group, you go to the healthcare one. If you go to transportation, whatever area you're interested in, that's where you go. And we go as a group. So there's Democrats and Republicans in every one of our groups. And none of the meetings that we had were with members of both parties on Capitol Hill. The Republicans met with us separately from the Democrats, and the Republicans would rail on how much the Democrats stink, and the Democrats would rail on how much the Republicans stink. This was 2015. This was 4 years ago. And all of us were blown away by how incredibly aggressive these folks were about one another in the presence of a room full of bipartisan elected officials. I mean, at one point in one of the meetings I was in, one of the guys literally looked at the folks from the feds and said, you know, both parties are here. You know, we have Democrats and Republicans in this room. And I think they need to stop thinking it's about them and start thinking it's about the people who elected them.
So you're an equal blame kind of guy on this thing, are you?
I think there's more than enough blame to go around, yeah.
Bernier, you're in high – I'm sorry.
Just one more quick question before we go to Bernier. I apologize for this because this is a big deal, and I know you refiled a bill on this. These dangerousness hearings, which I think Bill Weld, your predecessor, he was the first governor that had these dangerous hearings, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Okay. Well, anyway, lots of people don't understand how someone that gets into court and they've done a lot of violent crimes and somehow they're out on bail, there is an option to have a dangerousness hearing, but I don't
very
think they
narrow
happen.
Circumstances.
Yes. So explain what you've done about dangerousness hearings.
So the bill that we filed was basically to say that it does two things. Number one, it broadens the number of categories that a court can actually consider for having a dangerousness hearing. And the second thing it does is it says the process for determining whether or not there should be a dangerousness hearing should be about the person who is before the court's entire criminal record and not just the thing they're there for that day. And the reason for that is you could be in court, as was the case down on the Cape, for a drunk driving charge, which in normal cases, drunk driving charge, you come in and, you know, you get a date and you go, right? But this particular guy who was in front of the court for a drunk driving charge had two or three other very major violent crimes that he had pending, which he was already out on bail for, and they were not considered as part of the decision to treat his drunk driving thing as a single issue. And he ended up in a high-speed car chase shortly after that with local police and drove head-on into a new father who was on the way home from the hospital having seen his new baby for the first time, and he was killed. The driver, actually, the Mickey Rivera, who was the driver of the vehicle that hit him, also died several days later. But it seems perfectly reasonable to me that if we don't want to use bail as a financial device to make it hard for people who don't have means to get out of prison, which I am all for, okay, then there needs to be some mechanism in place that makes it possible for the courts to determine the full body of somebody's criminal record when they make a decision about whether or not to hold them, or at least to have a hearing to determine if they're dangerous and should be held prior to trial. And that's really what we're looking for here.
And what's the status of that bill?
We literally just filed it. It was our first filing of this legislative session.
Okay.
I expect that it will get a hearing, and I'm quite sure that a lot of victims' rights advocates and a lot of folks from the law enforcement community and a lot of local officials are going to show up and testify on behalf of it. And there was just an SJC decision issued the other day on a case that involved a pretrial detention of two individuals, one of whom basically was charged with an incendiary device, which was a gasoline can he set on fire at the end of the driveway of his girlfriend's home. And he ended up getting held, not so much because of the incendiary device, but because in domestic violence cases in Massachusetts, you can be held until trial because of the issues associated with Jared Remy, who we all remember.
Right.
The other guy was charged with statutory rape. He clicked his way online to find – he was 45 years old. He clicked his way online to finding a 15-year-old girl who he had sex with. And statutory rape is not one of the things you can hold somebody for. And, again, you can't bring the full case record, only what he's there for that day. So he was released. But I think this one – I think it deserves a public debate. No one wants to put somebody who made one mistake – or can't afford to pay their bail behind bars pending trial. No one. But we ought to be able to examine the full body of somebody's criminal record to determine if, in fact, there should be a hearing, and then if there is a hearing, to determine whether or not they should be held. And that's really what this is about.
Bernier, you've been patient. You're now on with the governor of the Commonwealth. That would be Charlie Baker. He's about to put on his headphones, so stick around for a second. Okay. There he is. Hi, Bernier. Welcome to the show. You're on with the governor.
Hi, Jim. Hello, governor.
Hey, Bernier. How are you?
You can hear him. Okay.
I'm well, thank you. Governor, you possess this political je ne sais quoi that most politicians would die to have. So I assume at some point you're going to run for president. So can you promise us not to go crazy like Mitt Romney, and because you have to go through the minefields of the loonies and the South and all of the Republican Party. Can you promise us in the Commonwealth to remain this authentic, smart, reasoned, fact-filled
person
that we have here?
I do love your audience, Jim.
Let me tell you, hey, he's tougher on us Bernier, than he is on you.
Yeah.
Bernier, I would just say to you, first of all, that the only job I've ever wanted in elective office is the one I have, other than being a member of the Board of Selectmen in Swampscott.
I don't know if you know, you had the most votes there ever. Did you know that? Didn't you get the most votes on the in Swampscott?
Yeah, I did.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine. Go ahead. Sorry.
But I think the I think this is this job, this state is a great place to have an opportunity to work in the public sector, and I really am. I'm not going to be running for higher office. This is the job that I want, and I really appreciate your comments.
Bernier, talk to you again soon. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Marianne. She's in Freetown. She's on with Governor Charlie Baker. Welcome, Marianne.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to thank the governor and use this forum as a way to spread the word about Schooner Ernestina Morrissey, which is a vessel.
What a great... great story. You should have these people on at some point
what
to
is
talk
it?
About the schooner.
Go ahead. It, go ahead, Marianne. What is it? Who is it? What is it?
It's the official vessel of the Commonwealth. It was built in Essex, Mass. In 1894. It fished out of Gloucester. Then it was bought by a man who took it to the Arctic for 20 years, doing scientific
Burnett.
Research.
Some of the Burnett,
research,
right?
Some of the research. Excuse me?
His name was Burnett, right? Is it Barrett or Burnett?
Bartlett.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Bartlett. You've read the book?
I have.
It's a great book, Phoenix of the Seas. Anyway.
Tell them what else the boat did.
Yeah, but they're still using some of the research that was collected during those voyages to the Arctic for climate investigations. She was in World War II in the Arctic.
Wow.
Up around Greenland, supporting the air bases. She was then pretty rough shape, and Bartlett had passed away, and she was bought by a Cape Verdean man, Mendez, who used it as a packet back and forth from Cape Verde to southern Massachusetts and New England for about 20 years. And then when the Cape Verdeans got their independence from Portugal, they found out that people were looking for the boat, and they decided to fix it up and send it back to the United States as a gift to the people of the United States, just like the French gave us the Statue of Liberty.
Marianne, is there a question at the end of this, by the way? I know you're...
not
really, no.
You asked me. Okay. It's a huge history. It's the official vessel. It's been back here since 82 and is owned by the Commonwealth. Right now it's in the Department of Conservation and Recreation, and a wonderful collection of the Commonwealth and some major benefactors and other...
We'll do something on it.
Ordinary people that I represent with the Schooner Ernestina Morrissey situation. In fact, we just sent $200,000 more of small donations plus some match.
Okay, we promise we will do something. Governor, do you want to comment on this?
The one thing
Thank
I would
you for
say,
the call.
Thanks,
addition,
Marianne.
The history of this vessel is really something. And one thing Marianne didn't mention is that... who's the guy that went to the North Pole?
Shackleton?
Yeah. A lot of Bartlett's work with a schooner up in the Arctic region was sort of fundamental to Shackleton figuring out how he could actually get to the North Pole.
Oh, really?
But the final thing I'll just say is we are going to, when this boat is when they finish the rebuild on it, it's going to be housed at Mass Maritime, and Mass Maritime is going to maintain it and use it. As a training vessel and an historic sort of statement, but it's a very special special vessel. It really is.
Governor, you mentioned Jared Remy before, and I think everybody knows he's in jail for life, having killed his girlfriend. There was this fabulous series, I thought, in the Boston Globe about the so-called, what they call the secret courts, which are these no-notice private hearings, often led by people with, some of them are not lawyers, some of them don't have college degrees, in which I would argue, and I think they argued, that otherwise pretty clear crimes are dismissed or just disappear. One of the most dramatic one to me was Jared Remy in 2001, I think, was charged with threatening to kill his girlfriend. And it was dismissed, and as you know as well as anybody, 12 years later, he actually did it. He didn't just threaten, he did kill his girlfriend. You, the Attorney General, have talked a lot about transparency in the wake of the Globe report. Transparency is wonderful. Why should they exist at all? No other state has these. Why shouldn't any matter that is potentially a crime be treated in the normal court system like anything else is?
So, first of all, we'll probably file something during this session to get at some of the issues that were raised in the Globe story. But one of the – remember here, the way these things work is the clerks take cases for determining probable cause. And it's really the arresting officers who make the decision about whether or not to send these cases to the clerks in the first place to determine if there is a probable cause. You know, they show up. There's a fight at a bar. They show up. There's clearly been a fight at the bar, but trying to figure out who started it and why and what the purpose was and all that. This is an administrative proceeding that they can use if they think that's a better way to try to get to probable cause. I think the transparency issue here is an important one. But the other thing I would say, getting back to the previous conversation we just had, we just passed a big criminal justice bill last year, and one of the major objectives of it was to find ways to make it possible for people who make one mistake to not end up having to wear that mistake like a tattoo for the rest of their lives. And these courts were set up fundamentally to serve that purpose. They were supposed to be the place where you would go on small-time things where the police weren't really sure if it was appropriate to turn this into a record and all the rest. But there definitely needs to be transparency around this so that people understand what's going in and what's going out. And on the Remy thing, I just have to say, he had many trips, not just before the clerk, magistrate,
yeah,
but before judges.
Yeah.
And the whole reason on 58, the whole reason we have a statute for domestic violence that says the whole record needs to be part of the trip before the court is because he had so many instances in so many different courts. And each time he went, they just treated it as the only time. And no one was putting together connecting the dots. And that's why I think we should connect the dots on other kinds of violent crime.
So the bottom line is, even though the other 49 states don't have it, you're okay if it continues as long as there's a greater degree of transparency.
We
definitely, is that a fair statement?
Yeah, we need to do things with respect to the rules and the standards and all the rest. But okay. I don't think the idea of having a vehicle that's an administrative process for particular situations that basically make it possible for somebody who or some group of somebodies who got themselves into trouble but probably don't deserve to end up with a criminal record. On its face, conceptually, that's not a bad idea.
Matt Bourne, you're on with the governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, Governor Baker. Great to talk to you.
Hi, Matt.
Just a question. I'm a furloughed social scientist working out of Woods Hole, and I've been trying to use the mass unemployment system online because you basically can't get through to anybody if you call, and but the system is just incredibly cumbersome and difficult to use and hard to kind of decipher. I applied a couple weeks ago and a week later received your guide in the mail, which is somewhat helpful, but it's been 3 weeks and they finally calculated my benefit amount, but I didn't realize the whole time I was supposed to be submitting requests for benefits each week. And so it's just a very confusing and I don't know if you have my question is, do you have a plan to look at the system?
Yes. The answer is yes. It's on the list. That system is on the list. I am not a fan of that platform. We need to, that system is going to get upgraded and simplified and we're going to do some of the same things with that one over the next few years that we've done with some of the other ones. And I agree, it's a very difficult system to use. Matt, can you give the producer your phone number and stuff? And I have a feeling that we're going to try and come up with a strategy to deal with folks like you who are in a very untenable position.
That means don't hang up, Matt, please. We will. One of our producers will take your number and give it to the governor's office, and thank you very much for your call, Matt.
We're talking with Governor Charlie Baker. He's with us until the top of the hour, which is 1 o'clock, taking our questions and yours. I'll try to get some emails. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Regan. Much more importantly, Governor Charlie Baker is here for his regular Ask the Governor. You can call him at 877-301-8970. Governor, the other day, a bunch of your colleagues in politics, including the mayor of Lawrence, expressed their anger, I think, at the fact that Columbia Gas was raising rates. And the quote from the mayor there, Rivera, I thought was brilliant. He said, "This isn't just another billing cycle. This is the billing cycle that followed them lighting our communities on fire." What's your reaction to what Columbia Gas is doing, and what are you going to do about it?
I think the first thing I would say is that our whole administration spent a ton of time up there for sort of 90 days or so. Some people were up there every day working on housing issues and road reconstruction and sort of all of the issues associated with thousands of homes and thousands of boilers and stoves and miles and miles and miles of mainline pipe. And there's no question that that incident created havoc and really just dismay and tragedy, at least one case, for people up in that region. And they have every right to be annoyed. I'd say two things. First is we need to figure out if, in fact, they raised rates, okay? I don't know the answer to that one. I did ask the people at DPU to look into it. The second is even if they didn't raise rates, and what they're really doing here is literally just they didn't bill anybody for sort of 60 days or so. So people may be getting what is, in fact, 2 or 3 months worth of their bill. They did a terrible job of communicating what they were doing. And for a lot of people, these things landed right around or right after Christmas. And for many of them, it was right around or right after they got their heat restored. And I just think the whole way they handled it was really badly managed. And what I would say is that our big objective through the DPU is to find out if, in fact, this is legit or not legit. And I tend to be, on most issues that involve Columbia Gas and the locals, we've pretty much sided with the locals because most of the time the locals have been right. So we're looking into this one.
You know, Governor Baker, I think the education reform bill was at 93. It's pretty old. Yeah. It needs to be updated. Sonia Chan-Diaz, the state senator, she just put another bill to increase funding for mass schools. She just filed another bill. There was one that didn't get anywhere last time. You said that you've got you have a foundation formula, I think it's called, yep, that needs to be updated. So
I can get really wonky and enigmatic on that if you'd like.
Okay, you can get wonky. Well, you know, I think we were speaking about the Globe story before. They had an incredible story about Brockton and Weston, where it had Brockton like spending like nothing per student, and Weston, which is a wealthy town, spending tons of money.
School supplies, $275 to a buck, basically.
Yeah, and also there was a complaint about the charter schools not being funded by the state, so that the local towns, yep, end up losing money to the charter schools. So go ahead.
The foundation formula was established when they passed the original education bill in the mid-1990s, and it has an inflation adjuster, which gets adjusted every year. A couple of years ago, maybe four now, there was a big commission to study the foundation formula to determine if, in fact, over the course of 20 years, the inflation adjusters and the factors associated with it had kept up with reality. Because you now had, you know, you have the forecast, and then you can lay it off against what actually happened over that time. And the conclusion of the commission was there were four areas in which the foundation commission said the foundation budget did not keep up with reality. One was the cost of health care to employees. Second was payments for English language learner students. The third was poverty, the way poverty was being calculated and dealt with, and the fourth was special education. And so the recommendation was that those four factors need to be updated to reflect what it really costs and not just what the formula said it would cost on a forecasted basis. We started several years ago working with the legislature to increase the spending on the health insurance one. And when we file our budget, we're going to propose a multi-year plan to update the foundation formula for all four of those factors based on the work and the
so towns
done on the foundation.
With those factors, a lot of special ed kids, a lot of second
low
language,
income,
they get
ELL,
more money.
Yes, exactly.
So,
and we're also going to make some adjustments that I think will help with some of the issues around charter schools too.
Yeah, because there's a legitimate hostility about charter schools having to do with not getting funding.
Certainly hostility.
Governor, though, if we can tie two things together before we get back to the calls. As you know, the millionaire's tax that the SJC determined shouldn't be on the ballot, of the roughly $2 billion a year it would have raised, $1 billion would have gone to education, $1 billion would have gone to transportation. Beyond the cost of the education reform that you and others in the legislature support, in December you put out this future of transportation thing. One of the observations, I don't know if it was a criticism or an observation, was that while a lot of
depends
the plans...
Depends upon the tone of voice, Jim.
Exactly. While a lot of the plans were good, how to pay for it was left open. That's really an expensive proposition. Equity in education without losing, and you know this better than I, another generation of kids, is a really expensive proposition. Are you convinced that maintaining your no new tax stance, you can find the money to adequately fund both of these initiatives that appear to be really important to you?
First of all, the Transportation Commission report, which I'm sure you can find on the state's website, if you're interested in transportation, it's worth taking a look at. It's two volumes. One volume is literally a data book. That's volume two. Volume one is actually the report itself. And I talked a lot about this in my inaugural address. There are a lot of really important and useful elements in that. But, you know, to start with element number one, invest in public transportation. We're planning to spend $8 billion on public transportation infrastructure over the course of the next 5 years, which will be the largest by more than two times five-year investment we've ever made in public transportation. We didn't make the investments we should have made for a really long time, and we're playing catch-up. Now, I would say to all of your listeners that while that's a really – this is necessary, important, and critical, and has to happen, and it will. But I would say to all your listeners who ride the public transportation system that this may create some disruption along the way, because one of the reasons people didn't make the investments in the system for a very long time is because making those investments need to be done in a way that creates, in some cases, disruption for people who ride the system, because – if you're repairing, modernizing, upgrading, and updating a system that is in operation 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, when you do the work associated with signals and tracks and systems and power generation and all the rest, you are going to end up creating diversions during that. So,
you're not talking about shutting, I mean, like the L
no,
line in New York City,
no,
which they backed off.
These will not be those kinds of disruptions. But I just think... I mean, I've scratched my head a number of times over why did we go so long without making these investments? And one of the things I concluded is people were just really nervous about doing it in the context of a system that's basically always on. But we have to make those investments. One of the second things they talked about was resiliency and investing in resiliency. We just worked with the legislature to get a $3 billion environmental bond bill passed, which has hundreds of millions of dollars for resiliency. And we're going to work with our colleagues in local government around municipal vulnerability planning, and I believe we can come up with other ways to support and fund some of that work. I think the transportation piece, when we file our budget, we know we need to file companion legislation at that time, and we'll talk about how we think we can pay for it. But I think the you know, it's funny, Jim, you brought up the millionaire's tax. Somewhere between $1.5 billion and $2 billion a year, I heard at least $10 billion worth of things that people wanted to spend it on.
So do we.
And that's why I think it's really important as we head down the road on the stuff we believe is important, on the stuff other people's important, people think is important. People need to lay out how they think they're going to pay for it, and we will.
Which means, but the end of the sentence is, and you believe there's enough money in the system without raising taxes to do what needs to be done on the education reform front and on the transportation front. Is that a fair statement?
Keep in mind that we...
I'm just signaling to Jim.
Oh.
It's a wave. But go ahead.
So he lets me get
the word answer that yes?
We did talk about creating a cap and investment program in my State of the State inaugural address as well, which has been very effective in energy with the Northeastern governors. We're going to try and do something like that with the Northeastern governors around transportation policy. And a cap and investment system, if we do it right, should create resources that we can invest in a lot of this stuff.
And that would be a revenue, I think the euphemism, that would you would acknowledge that as a revenue-raising thing. So how do you justify that within your historic position that we should not be raising new revenues? How does that fit within that?
Everybody pulls the revenue button to do everything. And most of the time they're pulling it to spend money on stuff we're already doing. I'm not a big believer. We should live within our means to make the stuff that we currently do work.
Yeah, the reason I was signaling to Jim was I wanted to get this question about the MBTA in here. This is my crusade about why we people are retiring in their 50s in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that work for the state. This guy, Mark Williams from BU, points out the taxpayers could be in the hole. I'm sure I sure you saw this piece for $1.2 billion because there are more people now retired from the MBTA that are working for the MBTA and they're losing money all the time. And he blames, and Carmen Jr., I think the head of the Carmen Jr. just passed away, actually.
No. He's very much alive.
Gallew? Who's the guy? Gallew.
He might have been.
Previously.
The guy who's the head of the Carmen Union right now is Jim O'Brien.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he's alive.
No, this is the guy that was previous there. He's been retired for a long time. That's why you don't know. He just passed away a little while ago. Anyway.
That was a good zinger you got in there, Margaret, about him being retired many, many years.
Well, he had been retired, I believe, for 17 years.
But your point is.
When he retired. But anyway, the one of the problems with the T, and I think Deval Patrick fiddled with this a little bit, changed it a little bit for T employees hired after 2009. But people can retire at 55 years old with 60% of their salary. And unlike a lot of other state workers, they get not only their pension but their Social Security. That is one of the problems all around the state with pensions is, you know,
well,
we're all over the 55.
Just remember
we're not falling apart yet here, Governor Baker. Not yet.
Over 55?
Yeah, we're over 55.
I'd like to think I'm just over 55. That'd be great. Just one thing. The folks at the T pay into Social Security and they pay into a pension system.
Right.
The folks who work for municipal government, work for state government, don't get Social Security.
They do
don't
not.
Pay into it. Just
they do
get
not.
A pension.
That's right.
Okay.
But one of the complaints is that the Carmen Union managed to negotiate lower and lower payments into their pension system over the years, and this has resulted in this mess.
Yeah, this thing needs to get addressed. And we managed to work with the legislature last year on a bipartisan basis to get legislation passed that makes it possible for the T's pension system to join PRIM, which is the state system. And that would be good for two reasons. Number one, they have much bigger rates of return. And number two, their administrative expenses are a lot lower. Both of those things would be good for the health of the T's pension system. But we are currently, what do you call it, at a standoff with the union over joining because we have three votes on the board. They have three votes on the board. 3+3. It's dead. It's a dead stop. But this issue needs to be addressed, and we know it needs to be addressed.
What about
we expect the union to work with us on this because this is going to put their future employees
in terrible
in big
position.
Trouble if people don't get serious.
And the
about
age,
it.
The people, most people now make it that we live longer. We get to 80. You know, why are people still retiring in their 50s?
Well, there's a lot about the, depending upon which part of the public system you're talking about.
The MBTA.
You're just talking about the MBTA.
Well, no, I'm not. I'm talking about, I think there's a lot of things state troopers can be besides full-fledged chasing somebody down the highway, state troopers. They look very healthy. When I've been pulled over, Governor, I've noticed how buff those state troopers look. You know what I'm saying? They don't look like they need to retire at 55. I mean, the private sector doesn't get to do that.
I agree.
And
But they pay into a system, and the system they pay into is set up with a series of commitments. And we adjust those commitments over time based on the schedules, and I fully expect that if we need to do that, we will. But, you know, when correctional officers retire, when they hit retirement age, I don't begrudge them one second for that. That's a really, really tough and difficult job.
On a related note, Richard from Waltham is on the phone with Governor Charlie Baker. Richard, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak today. It's the first time calling. I love your show. Governor Baker, I am a retired correction officer. I've been retired 7 years. I did most of my time at MCI Concord. I was involved with the union, and I have had some involvement with you early on in the Weld administration, and you've always been a very avid supporter of us. But the main reason I'm calling, and I do have a state pension, but it's not nothing like what I've read about in the Herald the past couple of days.
Oh, not no, 500,000.
I meant when I said you guys earn it.
Go ahead, Richard.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, you know, my pension is very moderate, and I'm still working part-time, various jobs. And that was one of the reasons why we got that ability to retire early, that it would allow us to get into other sectors of the workplace other than corrections, which is a very high burnout. But my main concern is this, Governor. When I read in the paper, and it's bothered me for a number of years, a lot of these benefits that we got, the rank-and-file state employee got over the years, was well-justified because our salaries were very low when I first started back in 1981. And what happens is over the years is that the managers in these various departments, they benefit by them also. And these managers are making $200,000 a year. So when they go to retire, their 80% pension is based on that $200,000 a year and not what mine was based on at $65,000 a year. I was a sergeant when I retired, and my pension's based on $65,000 a year.
So what's your question,
these
Richard?
These managers should not be able to benefit by the same legislative benefits that we have gotten over the years through negotiating through our union.
Got it.
I think they should be capped.
He thinks they should be capped. By the way, to add to Richard's question, Governor, before you answer it, I'm sure you saw in the Globe. Well, you don't have to see it in the Globe. You know it. They listed the 100 top salaries in Massachusetts, state salaries. The lowest was $293,000. So the mean in that group make twice as much as the governor of the Commonwealth makes. And as per Richard, they're going to do pretty well in retirement. So what's your answer to the capping question?
First of all, the 100 people on that list, I think 97 of them work for the UMass system.
They do.
Which I think, as we also know, is funded mostly by non-tax revenue of one type or another. And I don't know if those – I don't know anything about whether the rates those people are being paid are consistent with, quote, what they would need to get paid in the market generally. But you got to work a certain number of years to get a pension. You can't get one for working 3 years. You got to work 20 or more. In some cases, you got to work 30, and you got to be over a certain age before you can take your retirement. And you contribute. The current contribution rate for people joining state government is 11%, which comes out of you. It's not 11% between the employer and the employee. It's 11% out of the employee, which is actually a rate that's significantly above what people on Social Security pay. The system itself is on a funding schedule. That funding schedule is sort of 25 years out into the future before it's fully funded. We take a look at this every year to figure out whether or not we need to do things with respect to what the system currently is set up to pay to ensure that people get the pension that they deserve, and especially the ones who get them who are like Richard, who put in their 25 or 30 years in what in many cases, especially corrections, is a very tough job.
Is a cap ever on your agenda?
I've talked to folks about caps of one type or another. The problem with a cap is where do you set it, what's the rationale, and how do you factor it into what people actually pay into the system? If everybody pays the same percentage into the system and plays by the same rules as everybody else, that's usually how people define equity.
We have an email from John in Plymouth. He wants to know if you could talk a little bit about the smart energy program. He says he installed solar panels and is now waiting for approval from the Department of Energy Resources, which he's been told by the solar company there's a big backlog. And he wants to know if that's true and how long we have to wait before he can switch on his new solar system.
Well, what I would say to John is that I'm assuming he already gave his information to the producer.
No, actually, we have the email.
I mean, Massachusetts has one of the most generous solar programs in the country, and that's been the case forever. And it's grown a pretty significant solar industry as a result, relative to what you would see in other parts of the country per capita, however you want to measure it. I happen to be a big supporter of the SMART program, which is the program he's talking about. And if there's a backlog, then we need to do something about that. But that's the first I've heard of it.
We'll forward the email. Governor, Marjorie often talks when you're not here, maybe when you're here too, about her favorite photograph is the Forced March photograph from February of 2015, which I know you don't think is funny, but she does, when the people were walking alongside whatever was commuter rail. Someone said to me this morning when you were coming in, that they thought it was deja vu all over again, potentially Saturday night with another polar vortex, not unlike what happened exactly 4 years ago. Are you nervous about this thing?
Yes. The polar vortex, I won't go too far into the details, but what that actually refers to is there's a whole ton of cold air that usually sits on the top of the Arctic, and because of the warming of the ocean that's taken place and the warming of the atmosphere that's taken place, the warm air pushes that cold air off the top of the Arctic, and it comes down and typically lands somewhere in the eastern part of North America. And that is where the polar vortex, which is why we've had it sort of three or four times in the last 5 or 6 years. If it comes with a lot of precipitation, which it has in the past, we could see a lot of snow. And people have talked about the fact that depending upon how this storm plays through this weekend, you know, it could be 2 feet in Western Mass and 8 to 12 in Eastern Mass. If it moves
inches.
A little, yeah,
interesting.
It could move out. It could move out a little over the water. We'll see. But the bottom line is this very mild weather we've been having as that polar vortex breaks up and slides off the Arctic and comes down into North America basically means that we should expect it to get a lot colder around here and probably a lot snowier, which means you may see me on the TV in my, you know, my sweater and
snow gear.
Yeah, exactly. Telling you all to work from home if it's possible for you to do that.
Now, Robert just emailed. He wants to know, he wants to ask the governor where he can pick up an application for snow shoveling on the Red Line for Monday a.m. because he thinks there might be some jobs available to
him. We should definitely see if we get back to Robert on that one. I would love it to start snowing around, you know, 7 a.m. on Sunday and not around 2 a.m. on Monday
morning. Yeah, that would be – well, it's supposed to be Saturday night and Sunday,
right?
So well, let's keep our fingers crossed.
You know, Governor, I assume you've been following this, but because California moved up its primary to – I think it's March. The Secretary of State for Life, who was just reappointed or re-whatevered in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, okay.
Said that he was contemplating moving up the primary there, first in the nation primary, to maintain its status and not be – have all the candidates run out to California because it's so vote-rich, obviously – as early as December. So we could have a primary in New Hampshire as soon as 10 months from now. You've been pretty critical of Donald Trump. You didn't vote for Donald Trump. Have you thought about supporting a Republican challenger, if there is one, in a primary to the president, should he run for reelection?
Well, first of all, if we keep moving the primary dates up, when is like January 1st of 15 as far up as – or 16
it's
as far up
horrible.
As it can go.
I agree. It's horrible.
I love the way they do elections in some of these other countries where, you know, every once in a while I'll have some dignitary come through and I'll have a chance to chat with them. And I'll say, well, how long is your political campaign? And they'll say 35 days. I would love to live in a place like that.
Yeah, well, England has a statutory limit on the length of campaigns.
I think Canada does too.
But are you contemplating endorsing a Republican challenger, should there be one?
I'm focused on the job I have, Jim, and we'll see what happens going forward. I, generally speaking, don't think – it's going to depend on what happens. I mean, that's a really hard question to answer without having any idea about who else might be in the mix.
Can you imagine supporting Donald Trump in a primary come – well, ours would be –
I've already made pretty clear where I'm coming from on the president.
Meaning the answer is no, you wouldn't vote for him. We were about to ask you about sports betting, but it appears the Boston Herald beat us to it. Rhode Island now has sports betting. You apparently just filed something?
We did. The thing we filed is legislation that basically is based on the New Jersey bill, which was, I think, by most accounts, sort of the best way to frame it. And I think our view is, you know, it's legal, it's going to start happening in a lot of other states. We made pretty clear that we don't think you should be betting on high school and college games. This is just professional sports. And it establishes a regulatory structure run through the Gaming Commission for casinos and online wagering. And I think from our point of view, it's probably a conversation we need to have. And we think this is a relatively responsible way to go about doing it.
By the way, speaking of betting, are you making one of those ridiculous bets with the, I don't even know what Super state Bowl. Kansas City is in. Is it Missouri or Missouri? I assume it's Missouri.
Yeah.
Are you making one of those ridiculous bets with the governor of Missouri?
We have not talked, and we have not made a bet, and I don't think we're going to. That seems to have moved out of fashion. The first year I was here, we made bets on all that stuff, and then over the course of time, a lot of the other governors just said, you know what, I don't really want
to
do that.
You going to the game?
No. I'm going to watch it in my neighbor's house, which is where I would normally do it.
Hey, you know what, if we had time...
Going to the game, it's
very cold.
It's far away, it's very cold.
I understand that.
It's kind of exciting about the offshore.
By the way, we just talked about the fact that it's likely to be a big snowstorm here.
That's right. The offshore wind thing is pretty exciting.
It's very exciting.
Tell people about it if they missed it.
We have the largest offshore wind project in U.S. history going on, and the best part about it is it's also at a very good price. And because of the success of our procurement, you now have Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Delaware, Rhode Island, like everybody down the East Coast, is decided that offshore wind is a good thing. I think over time, this could be the start of a very significant and important renewable energy business.
And
the feds actually put a bunch of their, they leased out a bunch of their water out in the ocean, and they got huge bids on it, primarily because of the excitement that was generated by our procurement.
Well, also, we talked to Walsh, with the mayor, about this the other day. The headquarters of one of those companies decided to move to Boston.
And they're also going to do a big piece of their assembly work in New Bedford at the terminal down there.
Okay, so if you're not going to make a stupid bet, for which we commend you, I should say. And you are not going there because there may be a polar vortex over your state, which is another good choice, I should say. I don't want to be partisan, but I'm with you on this. Give us a score, and so next time you're here, we can review your prediction. What is it? With your good friend Tom Brady, as we know. You caught a pass from Tom Brady. You wear that?
I did. Yeah. But the best thing I did was I got my head shaved sitting next to him.
I remember very well.
I might as well have been in my underwear. No one would have cared. No one would have noticed. I was invisible. I'm going with 38-35 Patriots, and it gets one on a Gostkowski field goal as time expires.
Ooh.
And the reason I'm going with such a high scoring game is I just can't. I mean, the last time these guys played, it was 43-40. I mean, they both know how to rack it up.
Yeah, the constant thing is Brady too old? Is Brady not too old? No, he's not too old, then he's too old. I mean, it's like every week.
The game he
played last week.
Sunday, how could anybody
say that?
I know,
he's not too old. He doesn't need to retire at 55. Never mind 45.
Governor, it's good to see you.
You
by the way,
much better diet than I do.
The calls we did not get to, we will take your phone number if you stay in line. Give the number to the governor's office. All the emails will be forwarded. Governor, it's great to see you again. We'll see you guys soon.
Thank you
very much, Governor Baker. Governor Charlie Baker joins us regularly for Ask the Governor. Coming up, WGBH science correspondent, host of Living Lab, Heather Goldstone, here to go over the latest headlines and tell us about how the shutdown is affecting science. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The monarch butterfly. This is a horrible story.
It's a horrible
monarch butterfly population is plummeting. 2018 was the hottest year on record for the Earth's oceans, and a former coal lobbyist who doesn't see climate change as a crisis is on track to be the next head of the EPA. Joining us to talk about these and other apocalyptic headlines is, I don't know why I'm laughing, is GBH's science correspondent Heather Goldstone. Heather's an expert in ocean science and the host of Living Lab Radio, which, of course, you can catch Sundays at noon right here on 89.7 and Mondays at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. on WCAI 90.1. Heather, nice to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk with you, I guess, if everything's going to be apocalyptic.
Well, it is what it is.
Well, let's start with something that is sort of apocalyptic or just sort of bizarre, that Andrew Wheeler is the president's Trump to head the Environmental Protection Agency, and he was a coal lobbyist. And obviously, people know that coal is a big problem for the environment. So it just seems crazy.
Well, I mean, think about who he's replacing, right? Who
yep.
was a lawyer who had sued the EPA, what, I think it was 14 times?
When he was the Attorney General of Oklahoma, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know that this is necessarily surprising. It's been interesting. I've read some analyses in the past couple of days saying that, in fact, some environmental groups, and this is not my own reporting, just to be clear, but, you know, that some environmental groups and advocates are actually even more concerned about Wheeler because they feel that he's actually likely to be far more effective in getting things done. So,
well, that's encouraging. I mean, it's what is happening in terms of EPA rollbacks? There's quite a few of them.
Well, yeah, but you know what's really interesting is that the EPA is shut down right now.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we've been looking at. And I've been finding it pretty amazing, actually, that many things in Congress seem to be kind of rolling along as usual while this shutdown goes on and completely disrupts the lives of so many workers. But yeah, I mean,
what about Woods Hole, Heather, where you work? There's a lot of federal grants and so forth down there, no?
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Actually, one of the challenges with this shutdown is actually how hard it is to get information, even basic information like how many federal employees are there in the town of Falmouth. We know that we have a U.S. Geological Survey Center here. We have the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, which is part of NOAA. Obviously, we have lots of federal employees here, but actually getting a number is difficult. In the early days of the shutdown, I actually got in touch with the director of communications at NOAA headquarters, who, you know, I got a reply email that just said, you know, I'm an accepted employee, EXC accepted employee, you know, able to work in support of mission critical things. But and here's some information about the shutdown. I was asking if I could interview somebody about the shutdown, and they said, no, nobody to interview. Here's some information if you have questions. And I sent back a question and said, can you actually tell me the number of NOAA employees who are working with pay, working without pay, and on furlough, and didn't get an answer. And I've heard from a lot of people that it's just really hard to even know. It's not clear that there's any one person who has that answer, because a lot of the decisions about who is still working and not working and whether they're, you know, paid or not are kind of being made at the local level. But definitely there are a lot of people. I mean, we've also got, I should mention here in Woods Hole, we've also got a Coast Guard station, right, where we know they're working without being paid. But in terms of the science activities, it's kind of hit or miss.
By the way, the only Coast Guard, as you well know, but I don't know if every listener does, I believe the only military branch ever that has not been paid during a government shutdown, and it's in part, not that it's a justification, but the explanation is, unlike the rest of the military, it's funded through the Pentagon. It's funded through the Department of Homeland Security. You know, can we go back to EPA for a second? One of the and a caller this morning said to us, and I think he's totally right, until people feel the impact of this shutdown personally, as opposed to seeing very sad, painful stories on television about other people's suffering, whether it's the worker themselves or some collateral damage, they're not going to be as up in arms as they should be. What is the essential shutting down of the EPA mean for real people, Heather?
Well, shutting down of the EPA in part means that there are not monitors, you know, doing the job of looking for pollution violations and enforcing pollution violations is maybe one of the, like, where the rubber hits the roads kind of things. Just like at FDA, we've heard, right, that food inspections are way down. Only kind of what they consider to be critical inspections are happening of the food supply. you know, it can be a little hard with these shutdowns to say, okay, what's the thing that's going to affect my daily life right now? Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, that might actually be the shutdown effects on TSA and air travel, right? But I think you have to take kind of the longer view, which is that there are a lot of functions that aren't happening right now that may not affect you know, your health and well-being exactly today, but because they aren't happening today, things just get totally backed up, and these are functions that can affect and have ripple effects out through the economy and through people's lives for months and years to come. And that backup of, you know, imagine if you're not at work for a month, the amount of work that piles up over that time. And so it even once they do come back to work, there's just a slowdown for a long time after that.
Well, you know, talking about delayed impact, and you are an ocean science expert, am I right that last year, the year just concluded, was the hottest year ever in the oceans on the planet? Is that accurate?
I believe that's what some analyses are saying. But of course, we often get these assessments of the past year climate, whether it was the hottest year on record or the hottest year in the ocean and that kind of thing, from either NOAA or NASA are two of them.
Oh, that's pretty good.
And those reports aren't coming out this month as they normally would be. We don't have those analyses of the past year's climate of extreme weather events from the past year because those were due to be coming out, I think, sometime around now. And those scientists are not there working on that.
But the predictions that I've read about what those numbers will show suggest, and I think you've read the same things, that it will be the hottest ocean year. What's the consequence? What's the consequence of that short-term and long-term, Heather?
Right. Well, I think we're starting to see, and as you said, you know, talking about lag time, that's kind of the story with the ocean. It's an enormous, enormous body of water. Not really sure how to even, you know, put that into words, the size of the ocean. And it takes a long time to heat that up, right? You've got to put a lot of energy into that water to heat it up. So the fact that we're seeing that warming happening throughout the ocean, we're seeing warming at depth as well as right at the surface, and we're seeing that warming in some cases proceeding much more rapidly than was expected, that's a clear warning sign, right? That the amount of heat and energy that we have put into the ocean as a result of burning fossil fuels is just enormous. And we're seeing those impacts. And then on the flip side of that, there's also kind of a delay, which is, you know, when the ocean is warmer, that can, for coastal areas like us, that can change our weather in the immediate sense. But in the long term, the energy that is in the ocean and the heat that is in the ocean is one of the main drivers of the climate system. And just like it takes a while and a lot of energy for that water to heat up, it takes a long time for that water to cool down once you have heated it up. And so it's one of the reasons that even if we were to stop burning fossil fuels right now, there'd be a long lag time in seeing climate and weather change. There's also the fact that, you know, the greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere would not immediately disappear. But we'd still have this warmer ocean for a long time. And there's a lot of, you know, inertia, momentum built into that system that those changes would hang around for a long time.
You know, one of the things, because I think a lot of us remember chasing butterflies around when we were kids or even as grown up, seeing these absolutely gorgeous monarch butterflies. This report about this massive decline in the population of monarch butterflies. What's going on?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story because we went into this doing our reporting having heard, like a lot of people are, that the monarchs are in trouble. There have been these massive declines, and there have been documented really big declines. And in fact, this year in California, for the western monarch population that spends the winter in California, a lot of concern because those numbers are really, really low. And the same thing has been seen with the overwintering population in Mexico, which those are the butterflies or are part of the population of butterflies that we would see up here during the summer. They migrate through the year, and it's this amazing migration that is not just, you know, it's amazing when, you know, a small bird or whatever makes it from the Arctic to the southern tip of South America. What the monarchs do to kind of layer on another aspect to it is it's a multi-generational migration, right? So in the fall, one generation of monarchs flies down, presumably to Mexico, and then it takes like three generations for them to work their way back up over the spring and summer to the northern parts of their range. And there's been kind of a mystery, because while those overwintering populations show these huge declines, we haven't seen the same kinds of declines in those spring and summer generations. And so trying to figure out the disconnect there has led to some interesting research. One recent study actually looked at a population of butterflies in Florida that has mostly been known to be resident. They don't migrate. But when they looked at the genetics of those butterflies, they said, well, actually, in fact, almost half of these butterflies are migrants from the eastern population. And so it's possible that what's happening and why we're not seeing the numbers in Mexico is that the butterflies just aren't getting there. They may be spending the winter like in Florida or along the Gulf Coast, which in some ways seems like good news, right? They're not just dying. But the reasons that they would be changing where they're spending the winter are not necessarily good news. It includes climate change, the fact that they may be encountering more extreme weather along their migration, and also they seem to be going farther and farther north during the spring and summer months. And so that migration is longer now. They may not be able to make it all the way to Mexico. And also those butterflies that are spending time in that Gulf Coast area seem to have higher levels of a parasite that can actually make their wings weaker. And so it may be that it's not clear, you know, what the cause and effect is there, but it may be actually that those butterflies are just not strong enough to make it all the way to Mexico.
You know, that multi-generational thing, I didn't know that. That is one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard.
Isn't that cool? I think that's one of the things that's just so amazing. Those monarch butterflies just kind of capture your imagination, besides the fact that they're absolutely beautiful, that they do this crazy multi-generational thing. It's not just, you know, that one individual has to survive this ordeal. It's really generation on generation.
You know, I was telling Jim before, one of the biggest thrills of my life was someone had a bunch of cocoons of monarch butterflies that they brought to a place I was at. And when they came out of the cocoons, I got to hold one on my finger for quite some time while their wings dried off.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't fly yet while their wings were still wet from the cocoon.
And so then
they open their wings slowly back and forth.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
And it takes quite a few minutes, and then they just fly away. But to have one right on your finger like that, it was just amazing. I wonder if this is linked to the bees at all, Heather, do you think?
Well, you know, the commonality being both are pollinator insects.
Yes,
there, right?
And they both are, you know, ingesting pesticides that we've heard about, too, in addition to the climate change issues.
And I think it's really not clear with the monarchs how much, you know, what that might be doing. There's been a lot of concern. I will say there's been concern about the availability of milkweed along their migration route, because that's what they need when they put their chrysalis on the milkweed, and then they eat the milkweed when they come out. And actually, we this past year took a number of monarchs all the way from caterpillar through to butterfly in our kitchen in a little aquarium.
And then
released them.
How great is that?
And it was amazing. And it's amazing how much milkweed those little caterpillars can eat and how much they grow. They go from being like this little speck to being a full caterpillar in, you know, like a couple of weeks. And it's amazing how much they can eat. And so people have been really encouraged to plant milkweed to help them in the same way that, you know, plant flowers and other like butterfly bush and that kind of thing to have the plants there for them and for the bees as well. But this monarch researcher that I spoke to, Andy Davis from University of Georgia, said he's really cautious about that because often when you go to like your local garden store, there's milkweed is not one species. There's a whole bunch of different species. And common milkweed that's native around here can be a really great food source and create big, strong monarch butterflies. But when you go to your garden store, you might also find these non-native tropical milkweeds. And they think those can actually interfere with the biology or interact differently with the biology of the monarchs. And he literally said might do more harm than good. So he really says if people want to plant milkweed, just absolutely make sure that if you really want to help the monarchs, make sure you're planting native milkweed.
Heather, thank you
Heather,
very
thanks,
much.
As always.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That's a beautiful story. That migration story is really awe-inspiring, is it not?
It certainly is. WGBH science correspondent Heather Goldstone joins us regularly. She's an expert in ocean science, host of Living Lab Radio, which you can catch Sundays at noon right here on 89.7 and Mondays at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. on WCAI 90.1. Coming up, We're opening up the lines and asking you, is less more? Have you become a Marie Kondo neatness disciple? Throw out your junk disciple. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. Again, thrift stores around the country are seeing unprecedented surge in donations. The Container Store's stock price is up, I think, roughly 40%. And Instagram is overpopulated with photos of towels rolled, I don't know, as tightly as one of Mary Berry's chocolate roulades. Why? Marie Kondo. Her show, as you know, Tidying Up with Marie Kondo, hit Netflix this month, and it's already dividing us into disciples and dissenters. We're asking which are you? Are you someone who gets joy and satisfaction from scaling down and streamlining? Are you a more is more enthusiast whose idea of interior design bliss is a bookcase buckling under the weight of a lifetime of books, including that set of encyclopedias that you haven't used in 20 years? 877-301-8970. Just say she is huge.
Huge.
Everywhere you
well,
turn.
Well, she's not huge. She's 4'7".
Well, she's actually
seven.
Quite small. Yeah, but I mean, you know what I mean. It is everywhere you
it's
turn.
Everywhere.
So are you a condo disciple? You are, right?
Absolutely. I haven't gotten far, but I did read about her and read about reorganizing your closet from long things on the left side to short things on the right-hand side. And you know what it means?
No.
It means I don't lose things in my closet anymore. It's
ooh,
a lifesaver, Jim.
Aren't you supposed to hold the thing in front of you?
That's to throw stuff out. That's to throw
right,
stuff out.
Does it bring you joy?
Does it bring you joy?
And if it brings you joy,
yes,
you keep it. And if it doesn't bring you joy, you dispose of
right,
it, correct?
You're supposed to look around your home and think about the things that bring you joy. And the other thing that she does, many of us are very guilty about giving things away.
Yeah.
Especially your parents' clothing, if they died, or it was one on the show of a spouse, the husband died, she can't get away. So you're supposed to thank the piece of clothing for its service, tell it you love it, and then either give it to the thrift store or put it in a plastic bag or whatever, get rid of it. So I like that because it eases some of your guilt when you can tell the piece of clothing, thank you for your service, and I love you. Now, I know.
Let me just give the number. 877-301-8970. Again, we want to know if you're a condo dissenter or a disciple. I am a big disciple, too. I am a huge condo disciple.
I have been in your car.
What's the
I
point?
Can't imagine what your house looks like.
Yeah,
you
why?
Are a hoarder, Jim. You are
say
a, hoarder.
I was a hoarder.
Yes, you are. You have things in the back of your car. You have an old car.
I have an old car.
I traded mine in.
I know
a
you
newer
did.
Car.
Okay, fine.
You still have the same old car.
Mm-hmm.
And it is full of stuff that you haven't probably seen since
2003. Why?
And plus, it smells of sour milk.
No, it used to smell of sour
milk.
And plus,
you have mushrooms growing in there.
I do have some mushrooms growing in the back. But putting that aside for a second, what I did, every single thing
mushrooms growing
in my
car.
First of all, it's very disrespectful you talk to me like that. That's one. And two, every single item that's in the car, and there are quite a few, I would acknowledge, I've held everyone right in front of me, and I've said, does this tire reinflator bring me joy? And if it does, I kept it, and most of it brought me joy. So let me put it this way. I was not being totally honest. I want to be.
Yeah.
I really want to be a disciple.
You're a hoarder.
I really do want to. I'm not
I know.
A hoarder.
Yes,
I'm
you
not,
are.
I'm, no, I'm
can
not
you
a hoarder.
Can you get into the bathtub at your house, or is it full of the Jim Browdy papers?
No, I have to rent a room at a hotel every time I want to take a shower.
Well,
it's
did
really
you read
expensive.
How 1 in 11 Americans have gotten storage space? They've hired
yes,
storage
indeed.
Space because they can't fit the stuff in their house.
But it is so we want to know which side you're on in the Marie Kondo debate. 877-301-8970. I think almost every single person I know, you know, the hoarding in 2013 was declared a psychological disorder.
It's a
you
TV
know?
Show.
Whatever it is. I know
about
there's a
hoarding.
Show. I don't care about the show. I'm talking about the American Psychological Association, whatever it's called. But I would argue, Marjorie, even though this is not my area of great scientific expertise, those people who have bought into the Kondo mystique to excess are as screwed up as those people who are hoarders. It is almost disease like. There is a middle ground that I try to achieve that I haven't quite gotten there yet, but
you know,
I'm working my way to do it.
Here's a great little story. We're lucky enough to get invited sometimes to go do
things,
to read the night before Christmas.
Oh, we
the
did
Boston
this year
Pops.
At the Pops.
It's a big thrill.
Yeah.
So this year Jim says, You know, I have my antler ears.
We wear little antlers, Christmas designs antlers, on our heads when we do it.
Yeah, that were there, like, that we wore 3 years ago.
3 years ago, yeah.
Still have.
They're in the back of the car.
In the back of his car.
Well, you know why?
For 3 years.
And we needed them, didn't we?
But they were eaten. No, we couldn't use them. They were eaten by mice.
They were not mice, by moths. They were eaten by moths.
They were eaten,
you know, the
by
top, point of the topic is
so
not to make
got
fun of me.
Mushrooms.
I don't have mushrooms.
And moths.
I could have mushrooms. It's damp in the
and
back.
And this putrid smell of sour
by the
milk.
Way, the smell was only like every parent. When your kids are little and you have milk in the car,
well, you know,
the car smells.
Kids. My car didn't,
you didn't smell.
It. No, it did not.
Okay, well, it's not about me. 877-301-897. Where are you on this whole condo thing? I will tell you, speaking of, I'm not a hoarder, despite what Marjorie says. I have too
I
many
things.
I have too many things. Everybody like me wants the streamline, mm-hmm. but it's not nearly as easy as Condo and you are suggesting.
Okay,
it
it's not
is,
easy.
Or we'd all be doing it. Paulette, you're in Rhode Island. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Paulette.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're excellent.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Good. I read Maria's book a couple of years ago, and one of the common phrases between my husband and I are, it doesn't spark joy anymore, and we get rid of it.
It's great.
And one of the reasons, yeah, it's great, because we're in our 60s, and we're trying to downsize, because if something were to happen to us, we don't want our kids to be coming into our house and saying, what the heck did they save this for? So we're trying to, you know, kind of do the work ahead of time. And then I was sick last week, and I binge-watched her TV show, and I spent a whole week cleaning out everything. And now I'm helping my employer, and now I'm helping my daughter.
Wow, you are a disciple. Hey, Paulette, thank you very much for your call. And let me just say one thing for those who are wannabe disciples like me and have not quite gotten there. There is a certain level of satisfaction when
it's
you
great.
Throw bags of crap
it's
away.
It's wonderful.
It is like it. There almost is a physical satisfaction. It's amazing. It really
and
is.
And you spend so much time looking for stuff. That was the thing about the closet.
Yeah.
You know, I can't find anything in my closet because
no.
it's all disjointed.
Sure.
Now it's organized, like I said, from the longest to the shortest.
Mm.
You put your coats on the left, your long dresses on the left, skirts and pants on the left, and it moves up to like blouses and shirts.
Well, you know, by the way, that level of organization that you apparently bring to your closets is evidenced every day at work. So it's quite clear that it's really working out there for you.
Well, I haven't got my workplace.
Who's on the show today?
And I haven't got the rest of my house fixed up, but
oh, yeah.
I'm working toward it. I have to get back into the book.
Catherine, you're in JP. You're on Boston Public Radio, and we're talking about Marie Kondo. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm so embarrassed that this is my first call in because I've been listening to your show forever, and
ooh.
You had Governor Baker on, and I decided to call about this kind of trivial show.
It's not trivial
at all.
It's not
trivial.
But go
it's very
ahead.
Important.
But the thing that I wanted to say, which I really appreciated the first time I watched the show, was that with all these reality TV shows, especially with like kind of home makeovers, you're assuming, or I was assuming at the towards the end, after they did all their tidying up, that some like interior designer was going to come in, or they were going to build all these shelves for them, and they actually didn't buy them anything. They actually just really worked with what they had, which I appreciated because I think there's a larger kind of theme in her show, at least in Japanese culture versus.
I think that's a great point, by the way.
Yeah, it's about consumerism and all the stuff. It's like so powerful for people with the clothing to just put all their clothes out. So even if they're not using them.
Yeah. Well, that was the rule that they used to. Remember the rule they used to have is if you haven't worn it in a year, get rid of it because you're not going to wear it.
6 months, whatever
it was. But I don't think she talks about that. But that's another stupid thing we all do. We save this. I mean, I've saved this coat. I finally get rid of it. I haven't worn it in 10 years.
I have a similar. And thank you very much. I'm sorry, Catherine. Go ahead.
No, I was going to just say for sure, although I have done the purge in the closet. And then the thing is with the purge, you just have to make sure you have at least a couple of outfits because around the holidays, I was like, what am I wearing? I think I have one pair of yoga pants and a pair of jeans left.
Hey, Catherine,
thank you for the call.
By the way, I have a similar rule, that one-year rule. Yep. If I have not worn an article of clothing since my bar mitzvah, I've decided to throw it out.
Yeah. Listen to this. About 25% of two-car garages in the United States of America do not have room to park even one car inside.
You know what's a good rule, by the way? You know, we were talking about the Steny Hoyer who was attempting to answer a question. He's the number two Democrat in the House, attempting to answer a question about whether or not he supported the 70% marginal tax rate proposed by Ocasio-Cortez, and he ultimately said he did not. He talked about this notion that essentially you got to pay for whatever you spend, and sort of the Republican version of that is if you're going to spend an extra dollar in the budget, you got to cut a dollar. Of course, threw that to the wind with the trillion-plus-dollar tax cut. You know what a good thing to do, and I mean this sincerely, is when you buy something new, this doesn't clean up all the crap you have that you should get rid of. When you buy something new, you should get rid of something old. So at least you maintain the same level of hoardicity, or whatever the word is, that you had before.
But every one of the Jim Browdy papers is very important.
Well, you know, in all seriousness, you say to yourself that... I mean, how many copies of certain things? It's not just the papers. How many copies? Like, there were certain flyers I used, for example. We're going to talk a little bit at this Mass Municipal Association Saturday about the Question 3 campaign in 1990.
Oh, that's right. 1990. And I was deciding, a long time ago.
I have in my garage, or I have maybe 5,000 flyers from the campaign. And you say to yourself, well, you need some of them. You're probably unlikely to distribute them again since the campaign was 28 years ago. So probably five. Would you say 5 or 10 would suffice?
How many did you have, Jim?
I literally checked the other day. I have maybe 5,000 flyers from the campaign.
In the garage, did you say?
I do.
Do you park your car in that garage?
No, it's a garage for more storage kind of thing. It's like an office kind of thing. Okay. Beth in New Hampshire, you're next. We're talking about Marie Kondo and which side you were on. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm kind of in the middle.
Okay.
But I will say that I was inspired to start cleaning out my stuff because I was the person who had to clean out my grandmother's stuff. And I was really tempted to, like, call, you know, Goodwill or just have somebody come in and take it all. But I knew that she hid money. So that made me start going through things. And I got to this suitcase, which was probably like 50 years old. And I was tempted just to throw it on the pile, but I opened it up, and inside I found my grandfather's ashes.
Oh, my God.
Well, Jim, you can relate to that because your mother's ashes
in the back
of your
car
for a decade.
Well, I did. That's, why do you do that? There is some truth to that.
The readers know about it. They're emailing.
Fine.
They know about the ashes in the back of
the car. So, Beth, the moral of that story is at least go through the stuff. Don't just throw it out, right? Because how bad would you? Of course, you wouldn't have known, I guess, if you'd just thrown out. So what'd you do with them, by the way? With his ashes?
Something not legal.
Oh.
Something.
You spread them over an area that meant a lot to him? Or you probably threw them at Fenway?
I did.
At Fenway?
I spread them. No, actually, when I was a kid... we were very, very, very poor, and my grandparents took us on vacation every year to Hampton Beach, and they used to take us out to lobster at this place called Brown's Lobster Pound.
Yeah.
And so I went there to the ocean, and I tossed his ashes.
I love that.
There.
I don't care if it's
illegal.
He
would love that.
Well, I love that, and I didn't even know your grandfather. That is beautiful. No, I'm serious. That is really, really great. Thanks for sharing the story, Beth.
Listen to this. This is pretty beautiful, too.
What's
Katie
that?
Says she read the book a few years ago, started folding clothes like she recommends. She does recommend you fold
really
your,
tight.
Like your underpants in a ball.
I do that.
Yeah.
I do, actually. I really do, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
And she has special ways to fold your socks and your T-shirts and stuff like that. Anyway, she says, Katie says, after watching the show, I've done steps 1, 2, 3, swear it's easier to breathe in my house. It just makes everything feel lighter and makes life so much easier. It also helped me to really understand that my mother, who died 6 years ago, is not in her things, but in me.
Oh, well,
that's
pretty. Well, you know what that relates to? Michael Norton was with us yesterday, who said, this is a variation on a theme. What does he suggest you buy for gifts, which also will, and we never talked about this with him, which also ensures you will not become a hoarder. Purchase experiences for people because they'll remember them more than a thing.
No, so. I think it's true. And that's why I've gotten 3 crock pots from Jim. I'm not using any of them now. I've got 3 crock pots.
Well, maybe you should, actually, instead of eating the crap.
Listen to this. What? Tom says, if it doesn't give you joy anymore, you're supposed to throw it away, according to her. He says it's time to say goodbye to his teenagers.
877-301-8897. Are you amazed by the – I don't know the history of that. Her impact is immense.
Huge.
It is – long before this Netflix thing, it is immense.
You know, hoarding is a big problem. I mean, there was a whole TV show about it. I know a couple of people in my life that are hoarders. I suspect you are one too.
I'm not – I'm really not a hoarder.
Okay.
I have too much stuff. I acknowledge I do.
It's really a problem. You know, you go into people's homes and there's just stuff everywhere piled up. No space open on the top of a table. Like you have all these tables covered in stuff. The dining room table, nobody can eat dinner anymore. The bath.
I've told you the story about 500 times. I'll tell it 500
times. Mr. Jerusalemme?
You remember one of my favorite clients who was like a 5-foot-tall, 80-some-year-old guy who lived in the South Bronx, which is where I was a legal service lawyer, who's about to be evicted for having what is called in New York City a Collier's mansion. The Collier's sisters were hoarders, and he was about to be evicted by a landlord who loved him, by the way, but evicted him, had to evict him because he was a fire hazard to the building. So another lawyer and I, Jerry Klein, who went on to become a judge and sadly died a couple of years ago, who was bigger than me, by the way, not taller, but big, we emptied everything in Mr. Jerusalemi's apartment, took hours, put it on the sidewalk. He's punching us as we're doing it. We find hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars of cash stuffed between. He used to sleep in the bathtub, by the way, because there was no room in his apartment. The end of the story, because I don't have enough time to tell the full thing, when I get to court a couple of days later and I'm telling the judge the landlord's not there, he can dismiss the case because Mr. Klein and I removed all the stuff. As he's about to dismiss the case, the landlord runs in breathlessly, who had just checked the apartment, and I said, well, we're going to dismiss the case because Jerry and I got rid of all the stuff. Mr. Jerusalemi, all 5 feet of him, had taken everything from the sidewalk and put it back in his apartment, every single shred of paper. In any case,
there's a happy ending, though.
The happy ending, which has nothing to do with him being a hoarder, is he met another hoarder in my office, who was another. She was actually 4'10" and also in her 80s, Mr. Pauline Gentilomo. And one night, I'm doing a rent strike in the worst part of South Bronx. I'm going down the street. It's midnight. There's nobody on the street except these two people in the distance. I drive down the street to see who is crazy enough to be walking on this really dangerous street in the South Bronx, arm in arm. Are my two little 5 feet clients, Jerusalemi and Gentilomo, who in their 80s had fallen in love and moved in with each other.
Talk about beautiful stories. And were there hoarding? They could hoard together.
By the way, he never got evicted. I don't know I can't remember what the outcome was. There was some compromise, but he didn't lose his apartment.
Lauren from Westbrook.
Hi,
Field.
Lauren. Hi,
Westbrook
Lauren.
Field.
Hello, wherever that is.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey there, guys.
Hi.
You know what? I don't know how I just picked up that you're from New York City, Jim, because...
Well, I'm from Philly, but I lived in New York for 15 years. Go ahead.
Oh, well, my dad was NYPD for 25 years.
Oh.
The Bronx was his last precinct.
Oh, well, that's where I spent 10 years.
Yankee Stadium, actually.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yes. But I've actually never heard of Mary before, but I've been a bit of a purger since I was a kid. I grew up in Brooklyn, and I lived sharing a bedroom with two of my sisters. And I just remember the first time I was able to get like my own bedroom. I think adopted at like 13 being a minimalist and really just getting rid of things. If I didn't look at them after a couple months. And now that I have kids, we do the same thing. My rule is that, if we haven't looked at it or played with it in 6 months, it needs to be donated.
But where does that come from? Does that come from the fact that you were in a cramped quarters with your siblings? Is that the genesis of this?
Probably. I think so.
I'm so envious.
I think I've just liked being that way. I like things, I like to be able to find stuff. I'm kind of a frantic, doing a million things at the last minute. So keeping less stuff made it easier for me to not lose things.
That's great. I think it's great.
That's a big thing. That's so true.
It is. And it was also a way for me to help control like anxiety and things like that developed over the years as I, became a mom, because being a mom can make you develop anxiety, I guess. but so much so that my husband and I are in the process of getting together. We're moving to build a tiny home.
Because you can move to a smaller place because you have so few things. Is that where you're going?
Yes, and we like it that way.
Well, that is great.
My husband's kind of just like, as long as he can stay fashionable, he will live anywhere. And I've convinced him we're going to start building our own tiny house.
Lauren, you are fabulous. That is a great tale. Thank you for sharing it with us. That is great.
She doesn't
even know who Marie Kondo is, and
Addie,
she was doing it.
Addie said that she's followed the Kondo method, changed the way she lives, what she brings into her house. She said she's having a baby in a few months, her first one, and all the stuff associated with having the baby is giving her more anxiety than the thought of going through childbirth. Wow. So there you go.
By the way, we're out of time. If anybody would like any of the 5,000 flyers from the Question 3 campaign in 1990... email us, and I could probably spare a few.
Coming up, the poet Richard Blanco joins us for another edition of Village Voice. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Join us on the line to lead another edition of Village Voice, where we discuss poetry and how it can help us better understand our lives and times, is Richard Blanco. Richard, of course, is the fifth presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history. His latest project is the fine press book Boundaries. It's a collaboration with photographer Jacob Hessler. Richard, welcome back and happy 2019.
Same to you. It's been a while.
It has indeed.
No, great to talk to you. Happy New Year, Richard. So what is your theme today, Richard?
Well, I thought we'd celebrate, honor, think about Martin Luther King Day, which is on Monday the 21st, and actually the six-year anniversary of when I read at the President Obama's inauguration. It was one of the first times in history where they changed the actual date because he wanted to do it on Martin Luther King Day. So it's kind of very special for me as well in that context. So we thought we...
Wait. Don't leave. I was unaware of that. Is that President Obama asked that the date of the inauguration be changed?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
That it coincides.
Remember he had to be sworn in earlier? In some justice's office, because by law, I think it had to be a certain date by the Constitution or by the law or something. And so he actually was sworn in earlier. And then so the swearing, if I remember correctly, unless I'm messing up history myself.
You know, Richard, I don't know if I asked you about this before, but I was down there covering the inaugural and had to get there early, of course. And it was so cold
freezing,
that day.
Right.
As you remember that? My computer froze. My pens froze. I had to use a pencil. I mean, we were all freezing to death out there. How was it for you with the wind? Because you were high above the wind sweeping. You must have been freezing to death.
Well, they had some kind of fur kind of blankets for us and some heating under the seats. And just watching Beyonce in front of me kept me pretty warm. I could deal with the heat, with the cold.
Yeah.
No, it was also, it was warm, but we were also huddled together. My mother was definitely, she's from Miami. She hasn't lived in Maine like I have. She was definitely complaining a little bit, but they did try to accommodate. So it was, at least in my memory, it wasn't that bad. But then again, it wasn't a time to complain for me.
You know what I realized? You may be right about the delay thing. I was just Googling it as you're speaking. But what did happen, which I had forgotten about, do you remember when John Roberts, I think it was the first, I'm pretty sure it was the first swearing in the Chief Justice did, remember he blew a word?
Right,
and because
right.
They were concerned
right.
That there was a constitutional problem.
Right, I
think
I
it was the next
something
day or
that.
The following day, there was a second swearing in at the White House. In any case, that's a great anniversary. So what are you reading to us today there, Richard?
Well, I'm going to start with one of my own poems, which was kind of a commission, but sort of an occasional poem. It was this great organization in St. Louis called St. Art, or Street Art, is a play on the spelling. And they did a whole festival of street artists and poets, and the theme was light and darkness, or despair and hope, and thinking about what they call the Del Mar Divide, which is Del Mar Boulevard in St. Louis, using street painting again and poets. And so I did two poems, one which is this one's called St. Louis Prayer Before Dawn, and then the other one was called St. Louis Prayer After Dawn. So this is in the darkness. And so it's the idea of hope and how arts can change some of the political, social, economic, and of course racial divide in St. Louis. And what I learned that was really fascinating to me, this idea of the Del Mar Boulevard, or the Del Mar Divide, as they call, you know, we don't really think about some of the ways that discrimination and racism reared its ugly head, besides sort of Jim Crow laws. But what happened was through zoning, through certain zoning and housing laws, people of color were not allowed to live in certain parts. So in Del Mar Boulevard, the north side is 98% black. The median income is $18,000 per year, and 10% of the population has bachelor's degrees. Just on the other side of the boulevard, it's 73% white. The median income is $50,000, and 70% have bachelor's degrees. Median household income on the one side is $73,000, and on the other side is $335,000. So it was a way of segregation that sort of was a little bit under the radar. And of course, throughout now, we're seeing the effects of that, as we know in St. Louis. So,
before,
anyway.
you can, before, Before you go, though, I'll continue on that note. One portion of one of the most powerful books I've ever read, Savage Inequalities by Jonathan Kozol, a Massachusetts guy, I'm pretty sure was about that divide in education. I think talking about East St. Louis, which may be another jurisdiction. So there are many manifestations
right.
of that, as you call it, the Del Mar divide there.
Yeah.
So take it away, Richard.
Yeah, and I think part of it is this idea, you know, that we learn in our history. It's, oh, there was slavery and there was Emancipation Proclamation. That's it. Slavery's over. You know, or discrimination is over. Yeah. Whereas really it's been a systemic racism. Of course, if we want to even think about what happened in incarceration is another way of sort of systemically prejudicing and kind of racism itself. So let's do this poem. St. Louis, prayer before dawn. Watch the dark sky mute amid the vigil of stars, a black and white prayer. Where there's hatred, let me sow love. Amen. Hear it above Del Mar Boulevard with its black and white stripes that divide the city into black and white voices. A time to rend and a time to sow. Listen to its north side, the din of gunfire, the silence of boarded up windows, the vagabond weeds creeping through the floorboards of abandoned homes, still echoing with children who prayed every night. And if I die before I wake, amen. Now listen to its south side, chit-chat about vacation spots, stock tips, and the alabaster blooms of dogwoods and gardens tended to by the help. The meek shall inherit the earth. Look into the shimmering windows framing cocktail parties filled with platters of gourmet cheese, fresh-cut flowers, and the bouquet of Merlot. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Amen. Don't close your eyes to the sooty plumes of smokestacks rising like sinister incense, tarnishing the moon. Where there is despair, hope. Compare it to the silver moonlight showering suburban rooftops, backyard decks, green lawns, and the Luna Moth's green angel wings. For it is in the giving that we receive. Amen. Churn with the Mississippi's waters as brown as the skin of the homeless with names, but no home except their shadows in an alley off Market Street. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Amen. Rest with them trying to rest under the arresting rain of fluorescent lights falling 20 stories from locked up office buildings, empty of executives but stocked with wealth. Easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. Sleep past dawn with faces resting on tender pillows, asleep under their thick comforters. Grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console. Amen. Wake up with faces on buses riding past the graffitied walls of their streets, mirroring the truth of their lives on the way to 10 boutique hotel rooms, wash shirts and press skirts, or cast concrete floors for luxury condos. Where there's doubt, faith. See the arch, not shimmering steel, but dull as nickel in the dark, a broken circle, a broken promise, not a gateway, but a gate closed on St. Louis, trapped in all its black and white. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Amen. Glory be, waiting for the dawn. Glory be, knowing the only dream worth dreaming is the one we dream together in every color, where there is darkness, light. Amen.
That was spectacular. Oh, my God.
You know...
So...
That was great.
Yes.
That was great.
I know. There's always that pause after a poem, right? It's like after a song.
Well, since you are reading it and people are hearing it and they're not reading it, point out you have, when you read this poem, which is an incredible poem, Richard, how you weave in parentheses, if you can see when you're reading it, one of my favorite poems, The Prayer of St. Francis, and part of the Gospel of Matthew, you get all these... that prayer in Ecclesiastes, the time to rend and time to sow. You've woven those all in parentheses.
Yes, yes, that was part of the concept of prayer or of evocation, and those two are also some of my favorite prayers or passages. But also thinking about how so much of the civil rights movement is rooted also in Christianity, and thinking about how, in a way, that was also a way to have this, to have a discussion about equality and about civil rights was through very much the church. I mean, the Reverend Martin Luther King, right? So I thought that was also paying, in a way, homage to that idea or that history, right? It's strange how poems come together sometimes, or what the subconscious sort of starts thinking fits together. But it's also, you know, it's a prayer. It's an invocation to end this darkness, right?
Yeah, and the prayer of St. Francis, for people who don't know it, is great. And you've got the Beatitudes, of course, which a lot of people know from the New Testament. But you've got woven that in there, too. It's great.
Can I just say one more thing? We were talking about the Del Mar Divide at the beginning of this thing, and it reminded me of something. Do you remember, Richard may not, but you and I do, the Blanco Capuano campaign. Part of the message of Presley, I was just looking up from her community swearing in this past weekend, from Cambridge to Roxbury, a nearly 3-mile radius, life expectancy drops by 30 years and median household income by $50,000. So needless to say, it's not just
St. Louis.
Del Mar.
Yeah, no, it's certainly not St. Louis, but I think that this is part of the history that's not always explained in the history books. This continuous systematic sort of oppression, prejudice, and again, I think in most people's sort of mind, there's this idea that, well, you know, slavery ended, and, you know, I was having this discussion with my brother, and this, you know, in a way, the perception was like, you know, well, you know, sort of, you know, why can't they, you know, when I use the word they, you know, there's a problem, as if it's a level playing field, right? And it hasn't been a level playing field. It's still not a level playing field, right? And
racism didn't end when Barack Obama was sworn in the second time.
No,
when
you were, and we didn't. We're certainly seeing it now, right? So, I hate to make light of it, but we're certainly seeing it now. And so this is still obviously when we remember Martin Luther King on Monday and today and then Monday, you know, thinking about how the struggle is still there, and it's kind of almost I think what, you know, it's kind of in a way almost it's slipperier, if that's a word. And so sometimes there's this, again, I think that's what happened with the presidency. There's this sort of also, even on the liberal end, right, there's this sort of false impression, hey, everything's fine. We got an African-American president. We've turned a corner. And as we saw, we hadn't.
Okay, Richard, next poem.
So this is Won't You Celebrate With Me, with Lucille Clifton, who passed away fairly recently in 2010. And she's one of the grand dames of poetry of black women, black African-American women, sort of a contemporary, not a contemporary, but sort of a parallel with some of the themes of our Maya Angelou and whatnot. And this is a very short poem. She is just wonderful. This is one of Bill Murray's favorite poets, by the way. Bill Murray has read some of her poetry on one of those late night shows. He's a real poetry enthusiast. This also weaves in the idea of being also, so when you're a black woman, there's also another layer of oppression, right? Another layer of prejudice, another layer to deal with. And so certainly there's a sort of pantheon of women that connect those two things and think about the intersection of those things. And it's actually very sort of just her poems are very empowering. They scream at you, but they make you want to shout and celebrate as well, right? Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay, my one hand holding tight my other hand. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
That's exactly
right.
What I was going to do there, Marjorie.
What just a few lines of poetry can do. And of course, the killer is that last line, right? And then there's a line breaks that something has tried to kill me and has failed. And so what I find, in general, this is a real big generalization, but African-American women poets, black women poets from this era, they also find in some ways a kind of power. They present the issues, but they also sort of have a kind of power that breaks through, an empowerment. And this is part of because I think it's a reflection of how, much like in Latino culture, that African American women, like my own culture, women are like the backbone. They carry this weight, and somehow that double burden makes them see some other kind of light, if you will. It makes them, in a way, even stronger. And you see this theme recurring. Like if you think about Maya Angelou's poem, "And Still I Rise, I Rise." I was just listening to her yesterday. She could read the alphabet and I'd be crying, as they say. But this idea that they break through to some other kind of positive sense of empowerment.
You know, Richard, we talked so long about St. Louis, Prayer Before Dawn, that we're out of time for the last one, the interpretation of a poem by Frost. Can we save it for next time?
Yeah, or we can save it for next time, or we can also put it up on the website.
We can put it up on the website. It was my fault. I was going on and on about this.
No, I didn't think we were going to have enough time. But just real quickly, just so people know, that piece is really a masterful piece, and it's a play. It's sort of a sarcastic parody of Robert Frost Stopping by a Snowy.
It's brilliant.
What is it? Stopping by something on a snowy evening?
Yes.
Stopping by the woods on a snowy evening, and it sort of subverts that whole poem in terms of race, prejudice, and womanhood and gender.
We will post it.
And one most of us had to read in school, remember?
Indeed.
You had to memorize that one.
No, this is a great one.
Richard, so I think people will like it.
Happy New Year.
Right. Thank you.
Your poem was beautiful, by the way. Congratulations
on another spectacular poem. That Richard's was St. Louis, Prayer Before Dawn. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you. Look forward to the next
great.
Time.
Great.
Me too.
Well, Richard Blanco joins us twice a month for Village Voice. He's the fifth presidential inaugural poet in United States history. His latest project is the Fine Press book Boundaries, a collaboration with photographer Jacob Hessler. We are done. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us 24/7 by way of our podcast on iTunes or at the App Store. Tomorrow, join us in person at the Boston Public Library or listen to us on 89.7 WGBH, Callie Crossley, Emily Rooney. Boston Police Commissioner Willie Gross will be with us taking our questions and yours. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Mers, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John Claw Parker. What's on TV over there, Mr. Browdy?
We're going to have some people, sort of following up on our discussion a couple hours ago, we're going to have some people who are either themselves or representing others who are suffering in the real world. No statistics, none of that real world suffering is a result of this sadistic shutdown of the federal government.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great afternoon. Mm-hmm.